Hello, everyone, and welcome to Between the Sheets, episode 19. And we have a very loaded show tonight for a couple of various reasons, which I'll talk about in a minute. But first, I'll introduce my co-host, David Bixenspan. Bix, how you doing?
I am doing well. Happy. Well, I guess it's not going to be Thanksgiving weekend anymore when this is up.
But happy end of November Day, I guess.
Yeah, yes. Happy Thanksgiving weekend, everyone.
Exactly. Happy holidays. Happy Hanumas. Happy reindeer. Happy Christmas.
Hanumas?
I have a Jewish friend who celebrates Christmas, and he basically combines both holidays and calls them Hanumas.
And clearly he's never seen the OC.
He does Hanukkah and Christmas at the same time.
But why? Does he not call it Chrismica because he doesn't want to have it be too Jesus-y?
He likes Hanumas better, so it rolls off the tongue better, I guess you say. Hanumas, Chrismica is kind of a little bit wordy, but Hanumas is to the point. But anyway, enough Jewish foolishness. We have
speaking of Jewish foolishness,
yes, the first repeat guest on this show, so that makes it even a bigger show because we had to bring this guy on for a few reasons, which will be discussed later on in the show, but one of our most popular guests we've had on the show, and now part of his own podcast with our own David Bixenspan, the 605 podcast. That is Mr. Brian Last, the great Brian Last. Brian, how you doing?
I'd like to say shalom to everyone out there, and to make sure we don't leave anyone out, happy Kwanzaa.
That's right. That's right. Exactly.
And it's the Super Podcast.
I love
it's
that
the
that got
Super Podcast.
Yes, I love
Super
that
Podcast. That's right.
I love that got an exactly.
Super Duper Podcast. Superstars of the Super Podcast. Or Super Bouts of Super Podcast Bouts. So whatever, any way you want to get super in there.
Thanks for spoiling our quarterly special that we were going to announce. But
Clash of the Podcast.
It's great to be back on the show, though.
Awesome, awesome. Well, today we're discussing 2 weeks. That's right. Not one, but 2 weeks. We are going from November 24th to December the 7th, 1985. Here's the reason why. All right, when you get 1985 in years like this, there's sometimes not a whole lot of news going on because it's the early days of the Observer. There's no pro wrestling torch. News isn't flowing as freely as it would a few years later. So looking at everything that was going on, decided to do, hey, let's just go ahead and knock out 2 weeks. Now, this will not affect the show, as we will do December 1st through the 7th of another year next week. So don't worry about it. We're not going to skip a week. We're just doing a little consolidating here.
It's our own little double issue, but we're not using another week to go to Japan or anything like that.
Exactly.
But not double the length, hopefully.
Yeah. Yes. And we're big in Japan, but the thing is, I mean, a lot of stuff happened after the November 30th that had a lot of ramifications from the 24th to the 30th. So it's basically like a prologue of what happens. Or epilogue, which one comes after?
One's the prologue and the other is the epilogue. The prologue's first and the epilogue's
after. That's right. Epilogue's last. So, which is the epilogue of the first week. So, it's a good show because this is about going over the Thanksgiving Day cards of 1985, 30 years ago. And there's a lot of interesting stuff that happened. Of course, we lead off with Jim Crockett Promotions and the huge Starrcade 85, the gathering event. And with the influx of World Championship Wrestling episodes that popped up on WWE Network during the week, this era is profiled heavily, the lead to the show and the aftermath. So let's start with the shows, both in Greensboro and Atlanta. Greensboro did 18,000 fans. Atlanta was a full house, so it would have been around 16, 17, 18,000 itself. Few dark matches before the main card. We had Don Kernodle and Tommy Lane. Don Kernodle over Tommy Lane. Then we had Denny Brown defending his World Junior Heavyweight title against Rocky King.
Actually, wait a second. Wasn't Tommy Lane technically – was he LP or DJ?
They had then went to the names by this point.
Okay.
Yeah, so it is Tommy Lane proper, not LP or DJ, which was confusing as hell. But, yeah, Denny Brown and Rocky King in a dart match, Bix. For those of you that – there was a little joke before the show about Rocky King being involved in a dart match. So.
I didn't make the joke. You Ryan did.
Anyway.
Well, the joke was because while reviewing this show and getting ready for preparing for this broadcast that you're listening to, unfortunately, Chris mistook Rocky King for Sonny King.
Somehow.
And I forget what Bix said, but it always comes back to Bix.
No, I was just asking which were the dark matches on the card.
And then, yeah, I said typical racist Bix has to call the match with Sonny King a dark match.
And see, I had Sonny King on my mind when I was doing the results. So I typed Sonny instead of Rocky. And yes, we're not going to play that tire joke of they all look alike. So,
well, but hold on.
You just did.
The question begs to be asked, why did you have Sonny King on your mind?
I'm a big Sonny King fan. So I thought he was a great promo and he was a good worker. From what we had of him as an older wrestler, but I always dug Sonny King doing his black Kojak act with the sucking on a lollipop for George Championship Wrestling as the manager of Samoans. You know, I was real cool as a manager. So that's why I like Sonny King.
As far as lollipop gimmick wrestlers go, he's much, much, much better than Joey Ryan.
Okay. I shouldn't say it, but night and day.
Yeah. But anyway, let's go to the main card and we start. Now, we're going to go over Dave's thoughts on the show, Dave Meltzer, who didn't see the show when he typed it up in the results. He got it from a report from, I don't know if it was from Atlanta, from Greensboro, somebody that had watched the show, either live, closed circuit, wherever. So these are interesting thoughts, and that's why I wanted to run with them. Okay, we had the first match. Crusher Khrushchev winning the Mid-Atlantic heavyweight title against Sam Houston. Where Dave's saying apparently Crusher's complaining about having to lose was loud enough to change the original plan. Which, you know, Sam Houston was getting kind of a push at this time. And, you know, it is interesting that he lost this match to Crusher, who was like the third in line in the Russians.
Well, I have a question, though. When did he start dating Baby Doll?
I don't know if it was this early. I think it may have been a little bit later.
Okay.
They may have been talking though, but I do think it was a little bit later. Okay. Because Sam did continue to get some, you know, higher profile matches, but then all of a sudden he started falling apart.
Well, and he still, I mean, they did the whole thing where they sent him to Kansas City too in 86, but he was also the top babyface, Crockett's top babyface in Kansas City. So he still sort of had a push for another year or so.
Yeah. Then we had a great match. Mexican Death Match from Atlanta. Manny Fernandez going over Abdullah the Butcher. Double juice. Manny blading 15 seconds into the match. Of course, you had to climb the pole to get the sombrero, which Dave said made this result obvious. I mean, how could Abdullah ever climb a pole? Although he did get up there. Dave said, I guess he could by inhaling hard. He said, both guys look bad. I like this match a lot. I don't know whose thoughts they were originally, but I thought this was a fun match. Texas Bull Rope match. Ron Bass over Black Bart.
In Greensboro.
Another double juice match, which Dave said a world record was set here with 17 guys blading themselves on the card. And, of course, this was a good match, too. Then we had your follow-up where Ron got 5 minutes with JJ in a bull rope match. And, of course, JJ bladed heavily in this match. The best part about this is JJ's attire in this. He wore the tuxedo shirt. Am I right, Bix?
That sounds right. A lot of bloody tuxedos on this card.
Yeah, but I think he had that airport tuxedo shirt.
Yes.
Yes. Which is, you know, classic. And yes, like I said, there's a lot of blood. And speaking of blood, we go to Atlanta again. Superstar Billy Graham and the Barbarian, you know, arm wrestling contest. Paul Jones hits Barbarian with a cane. I mean, his superstar Billy Graham with a cane. Billy Graham juices, which looks like pink blood, is a very odd shade of blood on superstar Billy Graham, and a very short match. Thank God. Back to Greensboro, Nature Boy Betty Landell wins the national heavyweight title from Terry Taylor, which Dave heard was a very good match. This was the beginning of a big push for Landell, which, of course, we know what happens there.
Really, really good match, though.
Yeah, really good match. Back to Atlanta, national tag team title match. Ole and Arn Anderson defeated Wahoo and Billy Jack Haynes in the only match of the show, I think, that didn't have blood. I don't think anybody bled in this match, if I'm not mistaken, and Wahoo's involved. So, interesting.
Maybe he tried and it got stuck.
Maybe. Yeah, which had happened before. Greensboro, we had the I Quit match, of course, the famous one, Magnum and Tully in the cage. Now, here is where we get some interesting commentary. Dave talks about the match, you know, goes over all the deals there. Last sentence of the line, of the paragraph, I heard both guys really bled bad and the match was good. And I'm told this wasn't as good as their usual match because they had to waste time getting the mic into position whenever a submission was asked for. Think about that, folks.
Think people are jaded now.
I'm told this wasn't as good as their usual match. Now, this match is generally recognized by a lot of people today as maybe the greatest cage match in history. And it was not as good as their usual match. So, God, I wanted to see their usual matches after reading this. Hell. Then we get some fun stuff. Go back to Atlanta. Ronnie Garvin as drag queen Miss Atlanta Lively and Jimmy Valiant win the Atlanta Street Fight over the Midnight Express, Conjury and Eaton. The bleeders here were Valiant Eaton. Garvin wasn't exposed as a guy, although they did try and pull his pants off. This was real wild, and I heard one report saying it was the best match on the card. Garvin pinned Condria, and after the match, he and Valiant pulled Cornette's pants off, leaving him standing in polka dot underwear.
Now, I have a question. Yes. When they would show the matches from the other venue, was it just on the scoreboard screen, or did they move other screens to ringside, or how did it work?
Just on the scoreboard screen, mainly.
Okay, so if I had to take a guess, I'm going to guess that Dave's reports were all from Atlanta.
Well, see, that's on me. I don't know what Greensboro, how they had it set.
No, but I'm saying that maybe that Magnum Tully didn't translate as well if you're just watching it on the scoreboard.
Well, somebody had to have seen Magnum and Tully before. And
well, also the
Magnum and Tully did not have an Atlanta program.
Hmm. But also, well, you know what? It also could have been, well, then again, they could have been a closed circuit location. They would have seen everything as it came off on tape.
It could have been Richmond or some of the other venues that was closed circuit.
Actually, and yes, by the way, of the first four Starcades, this was the only one for years where the whole thing wasn't circulating among tape traders because it was the one year where, for some reason, they were able to scramble the satellite signal well. Like every other of the other first four closed circuit Starcades, the satellite feeds all got recorded and floated around for years, but the whole show was not available until, I believe, the launch of WWE Network last year, right?
That's right, yeah. Only ones around was the commercial tape, which cost $50 back in 1986.
Yes, so, from, what was the name of the company that they used? Liberty Marketing, Union Square Market. It was something weird like that. It wasn't Turnome Entertainment yet. Brian, you've been awfully quiet.
In a pink case, Brian. Did you have that? Did you have that commercial take? Because I got it. It's in a pink case.
I didn't. I had 86. I didn't have 85.
There's a color version too, but that's not as long. It's like 90 minutes instead of 2 hours.
Yeah.
But wait, Brian, any thoughts?
No, I mean, you know, you guys have been going through.
I was going to ask. I'm going over the whole card.
Then we'll share further thoughts. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Back to Greensboro we go. We had the steel cage for the tag titles. Rock and Roll's over the Koloffs. Blood, juice everywhere. You know, Rock and Roll's win. Gibson carried on a stretcher. Then we have the world title match, of course, where all the foolishness going on with Flair and Dusty. Dusty gets the visual pin on Flair. Dave says everyone was sent home told the title had changed. And all the newspapers in the Carolinas also reported that Dusty won the title. The story they're going to say is that Bob Geigel received a protest from Flair, who claimed that the moment the Andersons came in and interfered, it should have been automatic DQ, therefore negating everything that followed. My opinion of all this is that while it's better for the NWA or the world in general to have Flair as champion instead of Dusty, the reason for overturning is pretty ludicrous. And for all the folks who have been writing how it will cheapen the title to have Dusty the short-term champ in comparison to Hogan, how does Flair compare to Hogan when that fat slob pinned him before? It says 75,000 fans. It's more than that, which we'll talk about later. And many more who will view this when they eventually show it on WTBS. Actually, in all, my reports indicated the car was excellent. They did a good job of scrambling the thing, but hopefully I'll manage to find a tape of it somewhere down the line and report more on the future issue.
And he wasn't able to.
He kept asking for tape and Future Observers, but he eventually got it, of course.
So when was the first time that matches like the Magnum Tully cage match were commercially available? That was on the Crockett Cup tape in 87, but was that the first time that match got
86,
out?
86, when Starrcade 85 was released as a commercial tape in 86.
Oh, that's right. It was released as a commercial
tape. But it was for a long time that one was hard to find, eventually not as much, but it wasn't this big wide release like the later ones were, but like the Turner Home Entertainment stuff, but for a while, it seemed like it was second to Crockett Cup 86 in terms of rarity. Now, it seems like you find more and more of them. I mean, Crockett Cup 86 is still exceptionally difficult to find.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. But Dusty, the fat slob.
And Dusty was still a pretty good worker in 85.
Yeah, he was. And he hadn't started booking everything down the toilet yet either. So it's just Dave's personal thing is Dusty.
Do you guys remember what Dusty's entrance music was that night?
Purple Rain was 84, right?
Purple Rain was 84. 85, would that have been the live version of It's Only Rock and Roll or whatever it is by Bob Seger?
It was Bonnie Tyler, I Need a Hero.
That's right. Holding Out for a Hero, though. Joe Pedicino, Super Sons of Wrestling song. That's right.
Or the also known as the song from the Scott Steiner music video in WWA and a million other. Obviously it's a famous song. A lot been used a lot in wrestling though. Chris Dusty, Hero's entrance music at one time.
Dusty was using the Bob Seger live song for a lot on television at that time. So I totally forgot about Bonnie Tyler.
The one I remember the Bob Seger from the most is, was it Pro or Worldwide, where he did the impromptu match with Flair in 86.
Well, that. It was Pro, but they also used that was the theme song for the Risky Business Boys, where him and Ronnie Garvin would team up.
Right.
Dusty had all these great little one-off teams, of course, where him and Ronnie Garvin, Risky Business Boys, him and Manny, him and Magnum as either America's team or the
Dick Slater.
Yeah, the Dick Slater team. Dusty was always fun for having, you know, these one-off teams with random partners. But anyway, the card on itself, Brian. What did you think of Starrcade 85, and how did it stack up to 83 and 84 that came before it?
Well, 84 is commonly thought of as a one-match show, Tully versus Steamboat, and a bunch of disappointing stuff. 83, you have that great tag match, you have the dog collar match, and you have the Flair title match, which I've never been as crazy about as everyone else has. Gene Kaniski is probably the worst referee this side of Bronco Lubitsch I've ever seen in my life. 85 was, look, the Tully Magnum match may be the best match in Starrcade history. I think there's a valid argument to be made for that. And there's lots of other fun stuff on there. You know, one thing I wanted to point out earlier when you talked about how this was the beginning of the Buddy Landell push, which, you know, ended almost as soon as it began, it was also the beginning of the end of Terry Taylor. He was back in Mid-South UWF fairly quickly after this. This was really, I guess, the beginning of him burning bridges everywhere he went, where him and Dusty couldn't coexist, and then off he was.
Yeah, we'll be talking about that in a few minutes. And
the story of him and Dusty on the plane, is this from this era or is that from UWF era?
I think that was from UWF era.
Okay.
Yeah. But, Biggs, your thoughts on the card itself?
Oh, I feel like it's definitely the best of the Starrcades up to that point, top to bottom.
Yeah.
Like, I think you could make an argument that 83, in terms of just the way the top three or four matches are, that it's a more impressively top-heavy show. But I think overall, this is the best one up to that point. And yeah, as Brian said, the I Quit match is probably the best match in the history of Starrcade. I guess if you're looking for a number two, it would probably be the dog collar match.
Yeah. And, you know, Tully still points out to this day he never said I quit.
Right. It's yes.
He yelled yes.
Yeah.
That's it.
Which, and then of course that led to the fans chanting, "I quitted him," and that whole thing, which that's one of those things that if it happened now, like, it would seem very cheer-led and inorganic.
Yeah, I know.
It would be
They did it immediately.
Yeah, it would be very it would be like trying to, the Christian thing, CLB or whatever it was that totally failed.
Yeah, yeah.
Or something like that. But here, I mean, it just completely worked. I love the white tuxedos that the Midnight Express and Cornette have on.
Whenever you see someone in a white suit or a white tuxedo in wrestling, you know what's going to happen. You know there's going to be blood everywhere.
Yeah, and in the Midnight Express scrapbook, Cornette said something like, "Tuxedos are always get heat. So like everyone in tuxedos and it being white tuxedos, it was double heat."
Yeah,
but lots of blood. It is. It's kind of insane, though, to think about that there were 17 guys who gigged on this card. And that's a bit... Was it 17 that you said?
They said 17, but he also said Taylor Landell double-juiced.
Which they didn't.
So maybe 15.
Okay, he's still over a dozen.
Well, Dusty's in blood, you know?
Yeah, and that's the Dusty story, is overdoing it with blood during that period.
And also, and also gimmick matches, because like, I remember the first time I ever saw Starrcade 86, you know, the home video... It stuck out to me that of the matches they picked out for the home video, which was pretty much all the top matches on the card, all except Flair and Nikita were gimmick matches.
Exactly.
So, I mean, this is the biggest card of the year. I mean, but I think with the gimmick matches isn't that big a deal. I think the blood on this card probably is a bit excessive just for how far up and down the card it is.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
You know, I always found it funny that Ronnie Garvin really rips Dusty Rhodes every chance he gets. I don't know if it's different now that Dusty's dead, but every time you've ever seen Ronnie Garvin interviewed, he rips Dusty as being a terrible booker, that he did too many gimmicks, too many stupid gimmicks. And this is the first of two times that I could think of that Ronnie Garvin, you know, had a run in drag. It was this, and then it was when he was hiding in the closet dressed as Precious.
And he was really good in both roles.
yeah, but and he takes credit. He said, "Those are my ideas. I like dressing in drag."
I just listened to him on a obligatory Terry Garvin Sims podcast, and I don't know why it made me think the drag thing made me think of it specifically. But he like Pat Patterson, he didn't speak English when he came to the States.
No,
which I didn't know that. So. I just realized there's some terrible connotations to bring that all up together. Anyway.
Yeah, moving on. We go to the next night.
I apologize for that.
The next night, they had a promotional war in St. Louis where Crockett was teaming up with Bob Geigel to battle the WWF.
Yeah, but it's got to love teaming up with Bob Geigel to beat the WWF. That's a guy you want in your corner. Now, question. So is this the... When did the St. Louis Wrestling Club get dissolved? Or is it still technically the St. Louis Wrestling Club?
It's technically them, but January is when Crockett takes over as like the full-time
promoter. Okay, so this is maybe the last card ever at the St. Louis Wrestling Club, or next to last?
Pretty much, yeah. Okay. Because you look at the card, I mean, it's mainly all Crockett guys. We have Crusher Blackwell over a young Tatsutoshi Goto in the opening match. Tully Blanchard over Art Cruz. Landell and Taylor draw for the National Heavyweight title. We have Graham and Valiant over the Midnights by DQ. Magnum over Arn. Billy Jack, Haynes, and the Rock and Rolls over the Russians. And Flair and Dusty to a no contest for the world title. Drew 3,600 fans. Now, on the other side, WWF in St. Louis that evening. I had both of them as the keel, but one of them ran the arena. So I think.
I think because the arena at one point was known as the Kiel Center, right?
Yeah. So I think that's where
Kiel Auditorium, Kiel Center. Yeah.
Exactly. So same night, 4,300. So it's not that big of a difference as far as fans. Only 700 fan difference. But here's what WWF was running: Lanny Poff over Rene Goulet, King Tong over Terry Gibbs, Mike Rotundo over Les Thornton, Terry Funk over JYD by countout. The Dream Team defending their tag titles over the Killer Bees. Pedro Morales over Moondog Spot. And Andre the Giant over King Kong Bundy by DQ. Now, Brian, those two lineups I just read out, if you're a St. Louis fan, which one do you go to?
You got to Crockett, because other than Terry Funk, I don't think there's anyone on that WWF show that was a St. Louis star. Andre defeated King Kong Bundy. Andre may have made appearances, but he wasn't a big star there. Yeah, so I mean, if the Crockett show is the one that actually has people, especially Ric Flair, that they knew in St. Louis.
Yeah,
and it was still the NWA. I mean, even though Larry Madison broke off in 83 and did things, the NWA still meant a lot.
I mean, I guess Greg Valentine would be something of a fairly big St. Louis star on the WWF show, but that's about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they were running split crews, so that's why, you know, not all the stars were together at that time period. So, yeah, even though WWF had stronger television in St. Louis, which we'll talk about later on the show, if I'm a St. Louis guy, I'm going to the NWA, no doubt.
Now, there's something I added to the notes, and I'm trying to figure out if we should – because I put it after the next story, but I'm trying to figure out if it fits better here or after the next story.
Well, go ahead.
It's relevant to both.
Well, okay. We'll do it after this story.
Okay.
We'll tie it all up.
You get what I'm saying.
Jim Crockett Jr. filed a suit for more than $1 million against Vince McMahon at federal court in Richmond, Virginia on December the 2nd, charging that Titan Sports had violated federal and state antitrust laws, federal racketeering laws, and charging the Richmond Coliseum with breach of contract. Crockett and local promoter Joe Murnick contend that Titan Sports, in conspiracy with Spectacor Inc., which is a Philadelphia company that manages arenas around the country, including the Spectrum and Richmond Coliseum, has forced them out of the Coliseum, and also contend that they have approached WTVR in Richmond, which has broadcasted JCPenney programming for years, trying to force them to take that off their station in place of WWF programming. The issue started when Crockett, who has been drawing around 8,000 fans every other week in Richmond, tried to get dates on the Coliseum in 1986, but was told that he wasn't going to run there anymore as they had entered an exclusive lease with Titan Sports starting in January. Crockett's attorneys argued that McMahon's exclusive arrangements for both the Coliseum and WTVR deprived JCP of suitable facilities for wrestling and was calculated to expand McMahon's growing wrestling monopoly. McMahon was soon countersued Crockett, alleging that he had his own monopoly of Richmond, Charlotte, Norfolk, Greensboro, Spartanburg, Greenwood, South Carolina, and Savannah. That's not including Atlanta. To note, and other markets like that Crockett had taken on, you know, that year. To no one's surprise, both lawsuits would eventually get settled out of court, with Crockett agreeing to drop the charges in exchange for McMahon agreeing to let Crockett have one date a month at the Richmond Coliseum, and neither Vince or Jim admitted any wrongdoing. Meanwhile, the Missouri State Athletic Commission has denied Crockett's request to run St. Louis on New Year's Day because they don't want any more competing shows, and the WWF got the date first. Now, a little addendum to that, squelched, and they eventually ran on New Year's Day. So they got what they wanted in the end. But here we go. This is, it's hard to believe that it was 8 months earlier that Vince sold his TBS TV slot to Jim Crockett. And now here we go.
Well,
lawsuit bonanza.
Yes, they made a business deal, but it wasn't the friendliest business deal. Is it Vince who tells the story of what he said on the phone call, or is it Crockett that claims Vince said it? I think it's Vince, right?
Yeah.
That Vince claims he told Crockett, "You'll choke on that million."
Yeah.
I've always believed that there was a level of personal jealousy between Vince and Crockett. Not professional jealousy, but personal jealousy, in the sense that, if you really think about it, they're both from North Carolina. They're both the sons of wrestling promoters, although one of them denies that he's a junior. And one of them was part of a loving family relationship and a family business where, you know, he had a great relationship with his father. And the other one, his father really didn't have anything to do with him for most of his life, most of his early life. And I feel like there may be some resentment from Vince. Because, I mean, even today when you hear – when he did the Stone Cold Steve Austin podcast, he had – you know, he said great things about Bill Watts. But Crockett, he seemed to take a personal shot at that. He didn't think he was intelligent. And I feel so much of that comes from maybe just this resentment that, you know, he grew up having everything and I grew up on a trailer park having nothing.
I think when it comes to people liking Jim Crockett, Vince may be right behind David. Jim's own brother on that list. I mean, I could totally get that narrative. And I, you know, I've thought of that in the past, and it really does make a lot of sense. That, yeah, Vince was a North Carolina guy. You know, for many years, he grew up there. And, you know, wrestling, I mean, that's Jim Crockett Sr. I mean, that was the territory, you know. It was a big deal back then. And, yeah, you know, him seeing that, you know, his dad being a wrestling promoter and, you know, having all the issues with his dad over the years, yeah, I could totally get that vibe there, no doubt.
And, I mean, there's also the issue that the Crockett family at one point, or at least Crockett Sr., was worth a lot of money. I mean, maybe not more than, like, I don't know exactly how much Vince Sr. would have made, but Crockett Sr. was a very, very wealthy man for the era.
Well, he had baseball teams, and he promoted boxing. He promoted concerts.
Yep.
He was a promoter, you know, that's his life. You know, it was, everything was about promoting something. It wasn't just wrestling.
Also, did he own one of the baseball stadiums, like, for the Charlotte Orioles?
I don't know if he owned that one or if he had Norfolk.
But he owned one, right?
He owned the stadium, yeah. So, yeah, it could have been Richmond or one of the Tidewater. Yeah, he had stakes in minor league baseball stadium, at least one. So,
also, I'd love to know, like, I don't think I knew about this lawsuit. Like, I knew about all the Arena Wars stuff, but I wonder just how many times over the years Crockett or WCW sued WWF and back and forth. I feel like it's probably more than we realize.
I think this, if you notice, you know, Spectacore is involved in this, and I think this has a lot to do with Philadelphia more than you know. Richmond is one thing because, I mean, that's Crockett home territory. But Philadelphia, Crockett had come into, you know, run the Civic Center and, you know, been fairly successful against big WWF shows at the Spectrum. And you can believe that Crockett probably wanted to have a chance to run the Spectrum. And, of course, he wasn't going to be able to do it. And now the group that owns the Spectrum owns the Richmond Coliseum, and they're working with Vince. So
Vince realizes he has an ally here.
Exactly. And they try to pull this stuff on the Omni, too. You know, try to pull a deal on the Omni around this time period where they were promising to run a Saturday Night's Main Event at the Omni early in 1986. Because, you know, Crockett was running the Superstars of the Superstation in February. And Vince wanted to tape Saturday Night's Main Event in February to air, I guess, in March or whenever. March or April. So, there's a lot of you know, stuff going on here between the two. And Vince is pissed off because he's tried to run in Crockett Country and got killed.
And also, I'm guessing that this escalated to a lawsuit in part because I guess the Spectrum connection makes it a little more obvious.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on here. A lot of little things here and there.
Well, you know, again, too, it's not Crockett trying to go somewhere new. It's Crockett defending his home territory.
Exactly.
Richmond's his home territory.
Exactly. You're totally right. Now, speaking of people that were in and out of the territories and trying to defend their territories, Billy Jack Haynes quit after the WTBS TV tapings on December the 7th when he found out he was paid less for Starrcade than the Andersons and Wahoo McDaniel. So he packed up and went back to Portland. Haynes was written off television on the December 7th episode of Worldwide Wrestling, with the Barbarian giving him two big press slams. Billy Jack Haynes, for over a year, had burnt promotions to the ground, pretty much. Left World Class high and dry, left WWF high and dry. Now he's leaving Crockett.
Did he leave Portland on good terms?
He always left Portland right, because he always went back.
Was he in Crockett in 84 also before he went to WWF?
I think he may have done spot appearances because he worked for Georgia. Okay. And see, that was during the whole, you know, time period where there was a lot of, you know, gray matter to the promotions because they were all working together. So, yeah, he definitely was working Georgia when Georgia got bought out. But, Billy Jack Haynes, man, I mean, the guy who was being pushed as a, you know, the next big star in the business by the Aftermags and all this other stuff. And this is like maybe the end of him being that type of star, because when he finally went to WWF in 86, he was nowhere near the level of, you know, popularity that he was even at this time period. And Brian, you were around back then. You know how big he was getting pushed. I mean, they were Aftermags going gaga over this guy.
When you think of that period of time in those Aftermags, you think of Kerry Von Erich, you think of Tommy Rich, you think of Billy Jack Haynes. I mean, he was all over those magazines. It was the era when the physique started becoming the big thing and appearing on the cover of every magazine. And like you said, within a 2-year period, you know, he went from being the sensation in Portland with this great look. And every place he went, he burned the bridge. And every place he went, he got huge pushes. It wasn't like he went places and wasn't used. Everyone tried their best to use him to the best possible way. And it's just, you know, the stories about him being a head case really started there. And he would go back to the WWF in, I think, spring, summer of 86. And, you know, by that point in time, Vince McMahon's not going to push to the moon someone he has worries about, someone who he thinks could flake out at any point. So he leaves Crockett. One of the last things he did, obviously you mentioned he left after the December 7th TBS taping, but he appeared on the episode of Worldwide Wrestling where Jim Crockett Jr. would announce the upcoming World Television Title Tournament. And Jim Crockett Jr. brings out the first person he's going to announce that's in the tournament, Billy Jack Haynes, and says, "Here is one of the nicest guys in professional wrestling. Billy Jack Haynes," about a week and a half before he walks out of the company. And then he would go to Portland where he actually, it's a memorable angle there, too. He made his debut on TV. They brought him back as a surprise. And during that entire episode, as had been done in various other places like Florida and World Class, someone dressed like Santa Claus was hanging out in the arena the whole show and dancing around. And eventually it jumped up on the ring and attacked Billy Jack Haynes, which the camera missed, and was Rip Oliver,
who just come back from Florida.
That's right. It was his return as well. So it was a double return.
Now, when did Haynes start actually being full-time with Crockett as opposed to being a Florida guy coming in for shots?
May have been like 2 months before this. I want to say around September.
Whew, so he really did not stick around anywhere for long.
He flamed out everywhere. I mean, the WWF run from 86 to 87, I guess maybe into early 88. I'm not actually sure if he went into 88, but that's the longest run he had anywhere outside of Portland.
Yeah, that's correct.
Exactly.
Yeah. And also,
even, you know, you think about when he left there and went back to Portland and went and ran opposition to Don Owen, the guy, you know, that had given the work.
That's right.
Yeah. And then if he really did get paid less, I mean, he's not the level of star as the other guys in the match, but at the time. But
however, let me ask you this.
I mean, I was gonna say it generally it was standard to pay everyone the same match, except for like the NWA champion the same pay, especially in a tag match.
Right, but I don't know anything. I'm just making assumptions here. Yeah. I admit that.
Well. But,
If you had to guess with that match, after he finds out that the other guy's got more money than him, do you think Billy Jack went and sat down with Dusty and Jim Crockett and said, "Gentlemen, I have a problem with this. I'd like to explain my point of view. Will you please see fit to, if you agree with my point of view, compensate me fairly?" Or do you think he went in there with a check screaming and yelling to the point where they realized they couldn't deal with him anymore?
I think that would be the latter.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a hothead. Now, regarding the pay, most of the wrestlers earn between $10,000 to $15,000 for Starrcade.
Okay, we know that's not true.
Yeah, that was what was reported at the time by Dave.
Okay, because Cornette and the Midnights each got $5,000.
So, okay, I'm glad Cornette, you know, confirmed that was wrong. And it said, except Dusty and Flair, who earned considerably more, which that's understandable.
Now, is Corny probably the most open wrestling personality about pay in the history of the business?
I would think so, yeah.
Yes.
Now, Meltzer noted that Flair, Magnum, Landell, Eaton, and Cornette all have bought new expensive sports cars since the show.
and Buddy was probably living in it 3 months later.
Yeah, poor Bud Rowe. Now, the last note in the section, and this was mentioned earlier, also, at the December 7th TV tapings, Terry Taylor put in a 1 week's notice as he was going back to Mid-South because he felt like he was getting shafted by Dusty Rhodes' booking and felt as long as Magnum TA is around, he won't have a chance to become a top-level babyface. Now, if you watch Terry Taylor in Mid-South for the first 6 months of 1985, I mean, other than Duggan and Rock and Rolls, I mean, he's the next guy. I mean, he was North America champion, TV champion. He was their top single star that wasn't Duggan. And he goes to Crockett, and they give him the national heavyweight title, but he is mid-card to the team. He's feud with Black Bart, then with the Buddy. I mean, he never got, you know, that angle that, you know, was a big deal. And maybe is, you know, it was too soon or whatever, because Terry was only there for 6 months. But the fact that, you know, Mid-South's about to go national and they're doing big things. So I guess Terry is like, well, shit, you know, I know what I'll get here, so let me go here. You know, do you think he made the right choice, Bix? Or do you think that he should have stuck around Crockett a little bit longer?
I mean, I think it's kind of a question of, do you think he would have gotten the push he thought he deserved in Crockett? And my gut says no. You have the Rock and Rolls, you have Magnum. And when you look at how Dusty booked things later, like, you know, after Magnum had the accident, Wyndham comes in and kind of takes over his spot. But you don't really ever have anyone else that would fit into kind of the, you know, the kind of handsome sort of heartthrob singles babyface role alongside Magnum. And that's kind of what Taylor would have been. So I think in that sense, he made the right choice. I mean, in the long run, the other issues were not directly a consequence of him going to Mid-South. And as he said, he knew what he'd get from Watts. He even got the book briefly in 86. Yeah. So I think he did make the right choice.
Now, yeah, Brian, you were watching around this time period. Terry Taylor was, you know, perceived as one of the top, you know, young stars in the business. And, you know, like I said, Mid-South had pushed him to the moon. And yet he goes to Crockett and he becomes just another guy. Now, question is, now if he does stay, you know, we saw what would happen in 86, early 86, when Flair sidetracks to a feud with Ricky Morton. Do you think if Taylor's around, that Taylor gets that spot?
You know, I don't know. I think it was something that went throughout Terry Taylor's career where he had personality clashes with certain people. Bill Watts wasn't one of them. You got to remember, he goes into Bill Watts, and he's part of that wave of young heartthrob wrestlers, which changes the audience going to Mid-South Wrestling. Magnum TA was already there, but he came in with Rock and Roll Express. And you said that besides Jim Duggan, he was probably the top babyface in 85, early 85, and you're right. But he was also the last one remaining from that crew that had come in. So now they're all in Crockett already, and then he goes there. You know, quite honestly, I don't think he ever would have gotten over with the fans to that point as a heartthrob babyface. I think what no one really knew at the time was that he was a natural born heel. And what he would later show in UWF and World Class, if he had been that in Crockett Promotions in 86, then you're talking. Instead of him, you know, trying to figure out where he is in terms of Magnum's one and he's two, how about him against Magnum?
Are you okay? How about plugging him in the Landell spot?
Right.
You know, basically, you know, when Landell's gone, just switch Taylor.
Yeah.
But here's the thing, and you brought up a good point about the Mid-South. You know, one thing that Taylor got over in Mid-South that probably got him over more than anything else was Joel Watts, the Joel Watts videos.
That's right, the freeze frame video by Jay Giles.
Oh,
band.
Jesus Christ, freeze frame. Do you think I'm sexy? The other various videos it did, or the Super Data Superdome with Jerry Taylor. I mean, those got Taylor over more than anything else, I think, because it was just, and you can say the same thing for Rock and Rolls as well early on, was the video, but those were Memphis videos that they used at the beginning. But yeah. Terry Taylor was definitely a Joel Watts creation. And Joel Watts doesn't get nearly enough credit, you know, for doing that type of stuff and getting him over. So,
I mean, honestly, yeah. None of those guys get enough credit. I mean, because when you think about it, when people talk about the music videos, generally you hear Jerry Jarrett getting the credit as opposed to, you know, Randy West and Mike Shields and those guys.
Yeah, Joel Watts. I mean, the Fantastics had great videos when they were put together as a makeshift team. I mean, it was a big deal.
Well, everyone had great videos in Mid-South, whether DiBiase, Gino.
But see, the thing is, those guys were like automatically over. I'm talking about guys that were just coming in brand new.
Yeah, like, yeah.
You know?
It said to the young people that these guys are also young. They're part of the MTV generation.
Exactly.
They're listening to Van Halen and all the music you're listening to. They're not like last year's, you know, run of big, stiff wrestlers on top. These are young, faster guys who fit in more with the youth of America.
You talk about the youth of America. Now we're going to go to the youth of Japan, as New Japan has a big announcement on their December 6th World Pro Wrestling show on TBSI, as they announced that Akira Maeda, Yoshiaki Fujiwara, Nobuhiko Takada, Osamu Kido, and Kazuo Yamazaki will be returning to New Japan rings in January, and the UWF Young Boys will be coming along as well.
Who would that have been, by the way?
That would have been Anjo.
But Anjo, I think it started. Oh, okay. So when they say the Young Boys, they just mean everyone, even if
like
they weren't.
The trainees.
Well, I say because they weren't the Young Boys anymore, because some of them were wrestling already. Anjo was wrestling already, but he you mean because they hadn't been in New Japan? Got it.
Well, just their trainees and guys like that. Yeah.
No, but I'm saying because they had already debuted, as opposed to
All right, the belief is that the UWF versus NJPW feud will be what is needed to revitalize New Japan, like Ishin Gundam going to All Japan did earlier year in the year in December 84. This also comes on the heels of Seiji Sakaguchi signing a contract with Bill Watts in Mid-South weeks earlier for an exclusive deal, allowing their top guys to tour New Japan, and Sakaguchi, as well as Antonio Inoki, are meeting with Jerry Jarrett and Jerry Lawler on December 19th in San Jose about a working agreement with them, which Meltzer thinks is ludicrous because there is no one currently in Memphis that can get over in Japan other than Tommy Rogers. Now, Meltzer has heard that Jarrett, Lawler, Mike Graham, Kevin Sullivan, Inoki, Sakaguchi, and David and Joel Deaton representing the Crockett's were going to align with Lars Anderson and Leah Maivia to take over California from Vince. Meltzer fears, though, that every one of their top new heavyweights that comes in from Mid-South will do jobs for Inoki almost immediately. Some of the New Japan guys that were getting pushed more than normal, such as Don Arakawa and King Okamura, upset about the UWF guys coming back because their pushes could be stalling. Now, that meeting that Dave was alluding to on December 19th in San Jose didn't happen. some of those guys no showed, so that super meeting never took place. But the plan that was in action is quite the deal. Could you imagine like a movie about that, Brian? You know, getting all these you know wrestling honchos together in this one room to try to discuss taking out Vince.
Yes, all these wrestling honchos and the Deaton brothers.
And the Deatons.
Representing Jim Crockett. I don't know.
They were the concierges to the Crockett's, you know. Yeah.
I don't know. It's a couple of interesting things here. One is, you know, the exclusive agreement with Bill Watts couldn't have been that exclusive because Ted DiBiase was a regular with All Japan Pro Wrestling at this time.
This would have been for Duggan. In fact, Duggan, Dr. Death, and Butch Reed, who never went.
Right.
And Buzz Sawyer, I think, was involved. But I don't think he ever went for Mid-South. But those type of guys. But yeah, DiBiase had his own side deal with All Japan, yeah.
Now, actually...
Well, right before this, too, I believe Brody had made the deal for World Class, so Buzz Sawyer might have gone over, I think, with World Class.
Yeah, later on in the year.
In early 86, yeah.
Well, I guess both promotions, I mean, had deals with New Japan for a few years, right? Because, like, even into 87, you had Rick Steiner coming in.
And the thing is you had this deal going on with New Japan's, you know, got deals with both of those promotions, yet they hate each other. That hate's starting to rise around this time period.
And we'll talk about that more later too.
Yeah. So yeah, New Japan's like the caught in the middle of the whole deal.
This was a big deal, especially in Tokyo. The whole idea of the UWF guys coming back, it had only happened a couple years earlier where Shinma got forced out of New Japan Pro Wrestling. Sayama gets up and quits and says that wrestling's fake. And then Maeda and his whole crew feel disenfranchised from New Japan and leave. They start this group, which does pretty good in Tokyo and doesn't do any business really anywhere else. And then they go back and – you know, I love watching some of those like 10-man tags, and you see the heat just for the idea that Inoki and Maeda would go at it. There's that, that one.
Amazing.
There's that one where the teams are separating the two guys, and I love it because, you know, the New Japan team is separating Inoki, and I believe Kengo Kimura was on that team, so he couldn't have been too worried. And then the UWF team is separating Maeda before they actually do handshake, and Fujiwara is just standing in the back with his arms crossed, like the baddest motherfucker in the room.
Well, he was.
Well, he was.
And he was, but it's the coolest thing, yeah.
Yeah, the early part of that feud is fantastic. I mean, it definitely did what New Japan wanted to do. It got them hot. It revitalized their product. It changed their product. Because in 1985, they had a pretty crappy year. I mean, they were trying to do an Inoki Fujinami feud. And eventually, you know, this brings them back together. And even the couple weeks after this, with Brody and Snuka pulling what they pulled, you know, Brody refusing the job, and it made them change their booking plans and have Fujinami and Kimura take on Inoki and who's Inoki's partner?
Sakaguchi.
Sakaguchi, that's right.
Who Brody had beaten up.
Yeah, it was the Brody-Sakaguchi match that caused, you know, all the problems to really rise up.
Yeah, and then they had Fujinami pin Inoki to win the tag league. So they're starting something up, but now UWF guys are coming in, and they go to another direction. But, yeah, it definitely was needed. It definitely was needed to have those UWF guys show up.
And it's also interesting that the feelings that some of the New Japan guys had about they would be lost in the shuffle with the UWF guys coming back into the fold, it's almost exactly what happened a few years later when Ricky Choshu and his group came back, and Maeda and his group felt so insulted by it that it led to a whole bunch of other things.
Exactly.
Now I just lost my train of thought with what I was saying.
Sorry, Nick.
What were you talking about before you just said that? What part of this were we talking about?
We're talking about
Tokyo. The TV though did not benefit that well from that feud. I mean, whether it was the different style or whatever, like I don't remember if it outright hurt the TV ratings, but the UWF guys coming back did not help as in that area that much. It helped with house show business. But the TV had issues, I mean, going on through 87, where the show was in danger of being canceled.
Yeah.
And they did that whole thing where it turned into, like, a talk show with occasional wrestling clips for a few weeks until I think the ratings sank even more, and they realized, oh, well, people don't want to see this. They want to see wrestling. But, I mean, the whole not too much more to say, except, you know, I think it... I mean, I guess at that point, it's not necessarily UWF versus New Japan anymore, but even going into, like, 87, where you've had, you know, stuff like I've talked about on this show before, like the Maeda and Takada against Muto and Koshinaka feud, or Takada-Koshinaka, and all that, I mean, they really got a lot of mileage out of those guys coming back as, you know, their own group and that whole thing. And, yeah, I mean, I don't know. Now, one other question though: where did the TV matches for the original UWF air? Because they did have some kind of TV.
They aired in Dave Meltzer's house. No, I don't know. I actually don't know.
I'm sure one of the smaller networks aired it. I guess
like TV Tokyo or something, probably.
Probably, yeah.
Or was it maybe one of the things I heard once? And I'm not sure if that was what it was that maybe that it actually aired as part of World Pro Wrestling with the American matches.
Maybe. I mean, it aired somewhere because they got him. Yeah. Now, talking about Choshu, Dave had an interesting line about Choshu's crew, saying as good as Choshu's boys are, they aren't wrestling at the level they did for New Japan, mainly because of the quality of opposition.
Boy, that's something I would disagree with on every single point.
That's a loaded line there. Yeah, Dave never had the greatest opinion of Jumbo, and...
Tenryu at this point.
Or Tenryu, really, at this time period, too. So, you know, Dave was heavily a New Japan guy, you know, even in this time period.
But at this point, you've had almost the full year, and not that they were having bad matches in New Japan, but I mean, that whole feud, the Choshu's Army feud against New Japan, I mean, they had been having some incredible matches.
I guess, you know, he thought differently, and that wasn't his cup of tea at the time. I don't know, but yeah, that's just an interesting line. Now, during their match on December 4th in Osaka, Bruiser Brody and Hacksaw Higgins. That's right. Hacksaw Higgins is one of your top foreigners in New Japan this time period. Went to a double countout and brawled into the parking lot, which was a first-time ever deal in Japan. So Brody's doing a Brody match in Japan, you know, 1985. I can only imagine what the fans, you know, were doing. They were running crazy and shit. You know, as Brody and Higgins battled through the front doors or whatever they did, they go into the lot, but...
Yeah. Now, when did the WWF New Japan deal end officially?
This, right, you know, in before this. It was probably during the summer. Spring okay. or summer.
It was around then. So yeah, that's when Higgins...
There's a Bundy deal coming up later that we'll talk about.
Yeah, right. But, I mean, you just... I don't get the why... Nothing against Hacksaw Higgins, but I don't get why... Well, you know what? Something against Hacksaw Higgins. I mean, that is kind of scraping the bottom of the barrel at this point. Like... Did they? Was it just because it was tradition that most guys you booked through a promotion, and that's why it took some time because they had to make the deal with Mid-South and World Class?
I guess so. Yeah, there are some weird foreigners being brought in during this year because I mean, guys like you know Mario Milano was working in All Japan in 1985. I mean, there's just some odd people going in. Now I didn't put All Japan in the notes, but I kind of feel compelled to bring them up here. As they are having the Real World Tag League going off this time period. And there's, of course, some really solid matches. I'll give you a glimpse of what the teams were in this. We have Jesse Barr and Harley Race. That's a team you don't want to meet in the alley. Giant Baba and Dory Funk Jr.
That's a team I'd love to meet in an alley.
Yeah. Nick Botwinkle and Kurt Hennig, which they actually showed the Nick Botwinkle, Larry Zbyszko angle on World Pro Wrestling to get Nick over as a babyface. Before he came in for the tour, which I thought was interesting. Riki Choshu and Yoshiaki Yatsu, Ted DiBiase and Stan Hansen, the British Bulldogs, who we'll talk about them later, Ashura Hara and Rusher Kimura, and of course Tenryu and Jumbo. So there are your Real World Tag League competitors, and there is a match, I think it was on November 28th, and it may have been at Korakuen. But it was Choshu and Yatsu against Jumbo and Tenryu, a 30-minute draw, which was a fantastic match.
All of their matches together.
Totally. I mean, just fantastic stuff. And Brian, you were watching All Japan at that time period? Were you getting the tapes?
I have some tapes from that time period. I mean, look, it's really great. And, you know, I'm the type of person I can't think about that time period without thinking about what came next in terms of, you know, the Tenryu Jumbo feud. And, you know, here they are as a tag team. But it was good. It got better, I feel, after that. And unlike what Dave Meltzer wrote, I think Choshu and his crew kind of were great in All Japan. I don't know what Dave was writing.
Yeah. Now, as a tape guy, and me and Bix have talked about this before on the show, but, you know, when New Japan Classic started up, there was the anti-Choshu agenda, not showing any Choshu matches on All Japan Classics. Do you think that kind of hurt Choshu's standing in this country? Because, you know, All Japan's Classics aired, you know, most of your tape people were buying him up. And the only way you could get Choshu in All Japan was having to go find the television from, you know, certain tape dealers in Pennsylvania and New York that were selling them. So,
to get your old Dave Meltzer Japan comps.
Yeah, your old Dave Meltzer Japan copies. So, I mean, do you think that hurt Choshu's standing among the U.S. fans, you know, that were beginning to watch that stuff in that era?
Like later in the 90s.
In the 90s, yeah.
I don't know. I never really thought of Choshu having a standard or, you know, being hurt in that way. I always thought of him as being pretty prominent among tapes traders. When Meltzer raves about you and you're a tape trader, you'll find the tape. I mean, I don't feel like...
Well, but we're talking about, like, your 90s era, like, getting into your internet era tape traders.
Yeah, so you're talking
late 90s.
Yeah.
Yeah, the All Japan Classics era. You know, when those matches would have started airing would have been probably 99-ish in the timeline, maybe 98. So... You had this 2 year span where, like, the matches on Classics are not the level that they previously had been because they're not showing these main matches.
Right.
It's just something that's totally missing. It's like, you know, they whitewashed it from the records.
And a lot of the Tenru, even with other people, a lot of the Tenru stuff got cut too.
Yeah, I mean, you're missing some of Tenru and Jumbo's best stuff of the era because of the agenda against Shoshu.
Yeah, and I mean, it was a little weird too because Jumbo died in 99, was it 99 or 2000?
2000, wasn't it?
And this is in the middle of all this. I mean, or a year or two after that. And that, but that was also the first time that the complete Jumbo Choshu 60-minute draw came out, was on that. But they didn't relax the – I mean, I guess until Mrs. Baba was out of the picture, it didn't really seem like overall it was really relaxed at all until the stuff – start until like the second run of Samurai stuff aired and then when the G-plus stuff started.
Are you trying to say Mrs. Baba was spiteful?
No, never.
When did Giant Baba die? 97?
99, January 99.
January 99.
Okay, yeah. So.
Motoko would never do anything like that. I mean,
just ask Johnny Ace.
Didn't she once ban Dave Meltzer for a while because Mike Leno had showed up with a group of people and claimed that Dave Meltzer told him to come?
I've heard that story.
That had never been said, and then Mrs. Baba believed Mike Leno and banned Dave Meltzer from All Japan.
I can believe that. Anything involving Dr. Mike, I can believe. What a character he is, boy, I tell you. Well, on that note, we're going to take a quick break and let the Place to Be boys pay the bills. And when we come back, we're going to hit a little North America proper, I guess. We'll start in Canada and go to Mexico before we head back to the United States. We'll be right back after this.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com. The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes and PlaceToBeNation.com. You can check out myself and Scott Criscolo on The Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, home of great interviews and our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. If you need your fix of current wrestling talk, we have plenty of options for you there, including Main Events, which features a roundtable discussion led by PTBN analysts and special guests, our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, including immediate feedback and discussion for WWE, NXT, Ring of Honor, and New Japan Super Show, and Wrestling with Optimism, which focuses on the positives of the business. Also, be sure to relive wrestling's past with Graham Cawthon's excellent exclusive History of Wrestling podcast, Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave's Wrestling Culture podcast, our monthly pay-per-view rewind roundtable series led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance podcast starring myself and Pro Wrestling Only's Will, diving into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. Sports fans have plenty to dive into as well. We feature The Extra Point with Scott Criscolo and Dr. G, The Kings of Sport featuring Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, The Sports Sound hosted by Cowboy and Cowboy Senior, as well as the NBA Team Podcast, which takes a year-round deep dive into pro hoops. PTBN also proudly features Richard and the Mailman podcast, which specializes in the world of TV, thought leadership, anger, and irreverence. As mentioned, all these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. PTBN is also home to the tremendous in-depth features on pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments, and more. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island in Fall River, Massachusetts, Scott Keats, RSPWFAQ.com blog, and Piledriver.net.
Do you watch pro wrestling? Do you love pro wrestling? We do too. And there's only one podcast feed that you can't miss.
PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network. That's the Pro Wrestling Only, Place to Be Nation, Podcast Network.
We have a host of brilliant shows dedicated to wrestling past and present.
Whether it's the territories, Japan, Lucha, old school or new school, we've got something for you.
Get a dose of history on Exile on Bad Street with Chris Elmer.
Listen to reviews of current pay-per-views on the PTBN reaction shows. Not just WWE, but New Japan, Ring of Honor, and NXT. And get your weekly update on everything else that's going on in the indies, Lucha, and beyond on This Week in Wrestling.
Relive WCW Supercards on Where the Big Boys Play with Parv and Chad.
Join Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave on one of the very best shows for super hardcore nerds wrestling culture.
Go deep into WWF history and discover the Bob Backlund and Bruno Sammartino eras on Titans of Wrestling.
Don't miss the Pro Wrestling Super Show with Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston.
You can get the full archive of Goodwill Wrestling with Good Old Will from Texas.
There's Tag Teams back again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze.
Then there's the only pro wrestling game show, Brainbuster, with me, Johnny Sorrow, and a panel of great guests every time.
Get them all on one feed.
PWOPTBN Podcast Network.
You know you want to hear it.
And we're back, and listen to all those great podcasts you heard advertised in that previous clip, especially all the ones I'm part of. So, yeah, always support the Place to Be Nation, no doubt. Now, we're moving into the other areas of North America, Stampede Wrestling. One little news bit here. Gama Singh beat Bruce Hart for the British Commonwealth mid-heavyweight title in Calgary on December the 6th. Now, Bix, Gama Singh was a guy who, he got a little WWF run, you know, right before this, and like maybe 84 or whatever. But
I think it was 84 into 85.
Yeah, he never could seem to, like, break out into another territory. Why do you think that was?
I don't know, because great worker. I mean, excellent worker. Yeah. Really underrated. Not a bad promo at all. I mean, WWF, though, they booked him as a babyface, which, was not the best fit. And Calgary was a good fit for his working style, for sure. And I guess demographically, sort of. But then you also have the go-home packy chance, which, sure. But he... I don't really know. I mean, I think he could have fit in other places. I think if you had him somewhere like a... Toronto, I think he probably could have done well. Like, if you had him... But, I mean, that wasn't a full territory. Crockett, I guess, could have fit in work. Like, but I mean, he wasn't that big a guy, and he did have more of kind of a junior heavyweight. And he wasn't a high flyer.
I think he could have fit in Memphis real well.
Memphis probably wouldn't have been the best place size wise and all that. Yeah. But, you know, I don't know if. I mean, I guess at this point they didn't really have it anymore. But actually, wait, what year did he start in Calgary? About. I'm trying to think.
Oh,
I know.
Oh, man.
Because Calgary and Memphis sort of did have that loose relationship
before,
for years.
Before he was there, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Like, as far as guys going back and forth between those two territories, that was before he was there. Like, you know, Danny Davis and Ken Wayne. I mean, it was mostly the smaller guys you think of with that, although you had other guys like Wayne Ferris and David Schultz.
Yeah. No, he was there in 83, so he would have been there towards the end of that run.
Yeah.
But, okay, that would have been – I think he was around when Davis and Wayne were up there,
or at least when Davis was still there after Wayne left.
Now Brian, Bruce Hart, one of the nice guys in the business, right?
Well, not if you ask anyone in the Hart family. Real quick to go back to the previous question you just asked about why Great Gama didn't get over so well in the WWF. You know, I think it's. It was very easy for anyone in 84 and 85 to get lost in the shuffle there. They had so many wrestlers under contract and on the road. It was ridiculous.
Luke Poirier.
I forgot about that one. In terms of Bruce Hart, a very controversial guy within his own family. Someone who has certainly taken a lot of credit for things. I mean, the famous Bruce Hart story, which happened, a year earlier than this, or not even less, was when Stu Hart sold Calgary to Vince McMahon, and then Bruce Hart decided that he was going to just start up Calgary again, and that negated the deal.
Well, it's even better than that. It's the guys he went into business with decided they didn't need him, so they launched without a Hart, but it still negated the deal.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, because he had become... I guess Stu was officially the local promoter for the towns they allotted to him, which were, I guess, all the Stampede towns, including Vancouver, plus, like, Portland and Tacoma or something, and Seattle-Tacoma, I think.
Was it Vancouver too? I didn't know that.
Well, because he had been running Vancouver.
Yeah, he'd been running Vancouver. He run
and been doing great there. I mean, that's one of the reasons that Bruce was so upset when
he kicked Tomko's ass in Vancouver.
Well, and then he eventually, but Stu felt like he needed to give Tomko a percentage or something for doing nothing.
Yeah.
But that was one of the reasons Bruce was so pissed off, was that they were doing great business in Vancouver, like, because they had hooked up with. It was some concert promoter, Bruce something. I forget his name. But he had done they had done really well together. And then, of course, Bruce wasn't really consulted on it. I don't think any of the kids were. And then, of course, he was pissed that of the guys that Stu said you needed to give a wrestling job to, that Bruce was not one of them. That it was actually the only one of the sons who it was Brett. And then the others were Davey, Dynamite, and Nidark.
Son-in-laws, that's right.
And Dynamite, who wasn't even one of the sons-in-law, but was sort of an unofficial son-in-law because he was Davey's cousin, and also the connection through Brett and Brett's wife being the sister of Dynamite's wife.
Bruce is a guy who every time there was even a tiny, tiny chance he would get an opportunity with WWF in the later years, he would blow it by going into business for himself.
Yes.
Of course, when Brett had his feud with Owen in 94, the original idea that was pitched to Brett was, how about you against Bruce? And Brett put the kibosh on that like in 2 seconds and said, no way, I'll work with Owen. There was the time where I believe it was the Calgary Stampede show, the famed Calgary Stampede show, where Bruce was sitting at ringside and just started like stiffing, Steve Austin, just started throwing potatoes at him.
And then even the last time he worked for them, which was the Brett Vince match, when Natty and TJ were on, I think it was on Jericho's podcast, they started talking about how Bruce just starts commandeering the meeting and laying out spots when they're going over the match before, because it was all the Hart siblings were lumberjacks. Well, no, it was, I think all were lumberjacks except for Bruce, who was the referee, right?
Yeah.
And he just starts laying out spots and everyone's getting into an argument, and Natty and TJ, being the normal ones, are just face palming over the whole thing. But you know what? I mean, he was a very creative guy, though.
Yes.
Yeah.
The only time they ever turned the tables on him was in SummerSlam 93, when it was going to be Brett against Lawler, and then Doink came out to replace Lawler before the Lawler match. And Bruce didn't know they were going to throw a bucket of water on him. And they just got soaking wet. Yeah.
Yeah, that's hilarious. Man, Bruce Hart. Now we're going to move on to Mexico. And arguably the biggest match in the careers of legendary rivals El Solitario and Dr. Wagner Sr. took place on December the 1st at the Plaza de Toros Monumental de Monterrey with Rey Mendoza as the guest referee. And Solitario took Wagner's mask in front of 15,000 fans in the climax of their decades-long rivalry. This show drew the largest and most profitable gate in the history of Monterrey at that point in time. Now, Bix, we've seen this match.
One of the very few matches from that era that's on tape.
Exactly. And this is just an amazing spectacle to watch.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a long time since I've seen it, but it's a really, really good match. Just crazy, crazy heat. I wish we had more Monterrey stuff. I mean, we have more, like, a decent amount from, like, the early 90s. But yeah. I've always loved all the Monterrey stuff we have of like that era, the 80s to early 90s stuff. And I mean, these two were also best friends, if I remember correctly, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, they worked really well together. They knew what to do with each other. I mean, they loved working together. And then unfortunately, like, when was the car accident?
April 26, 86, maybe? April 23rd? Isn't April 86?
It's almost like kind of not with this compressed a timeline, but it's almost like another Art Barr type of situation. It kind of in reverse because of who loses the Lucha de Apuestas and all that, but where you have the biggest match of of Solitario's career. I mean, and he had been a much bigger star for a much longer time. But it's still, you have this big thing where he's still a big star, he's still a good worker, and then he just tragically dies not long after, this big, big match. And I guess then in a different direction, like, would be, Paraguayo Jr., who a few months before he was supposed to, like, have this big, lose his hair in this big match, he dies. So just weird, It feels like that type of thing has happened weirdly a lot in Mexico, doesn't it?
Yeah, it seems like there's a curse going on there. You know, it's just sad that those things happen. But yeah, there was some really other good matches on that card too. We had Io Dos Santos was in a tag match. A very young Io Dos Santos. I can't remember. I think it's Black Shadow or somebody was with him. And then there was a really good six-man tag match with Liz Mart, Mil Mascaras, and Valente Fernandez against Angel Blanco Jr., Sangre Chicana. I mean, these are really good matches. And definitely, Monterrey was a hotbed of lucha for many years, and you know we don't have a lot of it, and it's a shame.
I mean, it really didn't slow down that much until, what, 10 years ago?
It slowed down in the
a weekly city.
Yeah, in around 2003 and 2004, when the drug scene really started hitting hard, and people were scared to go up there. In the past, you know, 2 or 3 years, it's picked back up again. All the big names are going back through there again.
But right, they'll also run Arena Monterrey for big shows. And
yeah, there was a time there when nobody would go in that area because the drug dealers were holding the place hostage. You basically, right. If you wanted to run a show in Monterrey, you had to run it through the drug dealers. So.
Now, did that have to do with the AAA CMLL switch at Arena Coliseo in Monterrey?
No.
Was that completely unrelated?
Completely unrelated.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, on December 3rd...
Speaking of great matches on paper.
Yeah. At Arena Coliseo in Mexico City, Hueso Guerrero defeated El Monarca, Javier Cruz, to win the Mexican National Welterweight title. And yes, these two guys were great technicians.
Well, can you imagine those two in 1985 working a title match style match?
Oh, no, it would have been amazing. And Javier Cruz...
what an underrated worker.
...is having a hair match on December 17, 2015 against Satanico at Arena Jalisco. So,
is that going to make tape or video?
I'm sure it will be online.
YouTube or something.
Somebody will have it on YouTube, so yeah. Be on the lookout for that in a few weeks. So, yeah, Javier Cruz was a great underrated performer. And Fuerza is a, you know, just a phenomenon, even back then. Now, at the big year-end show at Arena Mexico on December the 6th, we had El Dandy defeating Gran Cochise in a Caballero contra Caballero match, hair match, which sounds fucking awesome. Then we had Solar 2, not Solar 1 that everybody knows about, the worst one, Negro Navarro, but Solar 2.
Who is going over, definitely not Solar 1 in many ways.
Yeah, going over El Belzebu in a Mascara contra Mascara match with Belzebu unmasking as Juan Manuel Linares from Guadalajara. So there's your big year-end Arena Mexico show.
Did he ever go on to do anything else, Belzebu?
Yeah, he worked as Rey Barbaro, I think. And
I know the name, Guadalajara. Yeah.
Yeah, so... Yeah, he worked a little bit longer after the match. But the funny thing is, you know, the reason why they had like year-end shows in early December was Arena Mexico would get rented out at the end of the year for the circus.
Mm-hmm.
So they would run the normal Friday shows at Arena Coliseo instead of Arena Mexico until January. So that's what the deal was. Kind of like how, you know, Madison Square Garden did that for years with the circus, right?
I don't think they'd rent it. I don't think they'd completely take over the building at the expense of other stuff, but
it happened.
But I mean,
San Antonio does that for the rodeo.
Right.
That's why the San Antonio Spurs have to take like a month and a half long road trip. They don't play at home for like a month and a half because of the rodeo. So, yeah, interesting stuff there. And now we'll go to the United States proper and to the western half of the country as we have all these territories to deal with. So we're splitting it up a little bit. We're going to go kind of west of the end of Texas, and then we'll come back east of Texas. All right, we'll start off with the AWA. And Thanksgiving night, they had their own little war going on with the World Wrestling Federation. As on November 28th, they ran St. Paul Civic Center with these great matches. We have Wild Bill Irwin going over Leon White, the future Vader, to a draw. Mongolian Stomper going over Kellen Kelly. Scott Hall going over Boris Zukov by
Not DQ. Place to be Nations, Kevin Kelly.
No, this is Nails, Kevin Kelly. AWA Heavyweight title and God, this what a match this was. Bug Zumhoff beating Steve Regal for the title.
That's Mr. Electricity.
Yep. And that series may be the worst rivalry in the history of wrestling. And this is for I watched every single one of those matches for the Death Valley Driver 80s AWA set. And you can ask Dylan Hales about these matches. I mean, oof. But the Road Warriors going over Michael Hayes and Buddy Roberts, which we'll talk about later on. Crusher Blackwell going over Michael Hayes. And a Battle Royal won by Scott Hall. Now, WWF on the other side of town at the Met Center. 15,000 strong there, which I don't have a concrete number on the AWA show, but I think they did around 13,000.
I think that's what was in the Observer. Yeah, both did really well.
Yeah, so strong showing from AWA to that time period, 13,000. Anyway, we have Dan Spivey going over Barry Orton, King Tonga going over Alexis Smirnoff, Pedro Morales going over Steve Lombardi, Jesse Ventura going over Uncle Elmer by DQ, the WWF World Heavyweight Champion Hulk Hogan with Mr. T, who Dave Meltzer calls a slime bag in the Observer for no reason. Pinning Macho Man Savage with Bobby Heenan as his manager with a clothesline after Savage was distracted by Mr. T, attacking Heenan, who had attempted to interfere moments earlier. Bob Orton Jr. going over Ivan Putski, Jim Brunzell over Terry Gibbs, and Paul Orndorff over Roddy Piper by DQ when Bob Orton Jr. interfered.
That's a two-match show if I've ever heard of one.
Brian, I asked you about the Crockett WF War in St. Louis earlier. Your thoughts on this one. Which show would you rather go to, AWA or WWF?
WWF. And the fact that they had Hogan Savage, which had just – they just did one angle on championship wrestling a few weeks before where Hulk Hogan for the first time in forever was going to have a non-title match on TV against Rusty Brooks from Denton County, the wrestler from Denton County who's not a slim Von Erich. And all of a sudden, Randy Savage runs out there and Elizabeth. And it's one of those rare times where Elizabeth did something. She gets in the ring and gets on the mic and says, "We want to know when you're going to actually face some real competition." And then Hogan goes after Rusty Brooks and Savage attacks him. And that began, you know, only a few months into Randy Savage's WWF run, that began a house show run against Hogan, which did fairly well.
At the Garden, especially.
At the Garden, they did a few matches. That's right. Right.
Well, and also, I mean, it shows how early it is in Savage's WWF run that you still have heel Elizabeth.
Yeah, right. people do not remember that. Elizabeth was a strong heel at the beginning.
You know, it's funny. If you watch those shows, it's really funny when you know where things go. It's Bruno Sammartino just constantly saying, "You know, Vince, I hear she's a very good negotiator. I hear she's a very firm negotiator." Because you never think of Elizabeth as that kind of manager who's like sitting down and negotiating contracts for the Macho Man.
but that was the idea, that she was supposed to be like this business shark, like with the idea that she stepped right off of the set of like Dynasty or Dallas or something.
That's right.
She was an early Alexandra York.
Yeah,
kind of.
kind of an early Dixie Carter.
Oh, God.
I thought we decided that was Ann Gunkel.
That's Ann Gunkel. Anyway, but also on that show.
No, Ann Gunkel was a much better promoter than Dixie Carter. She just looks like Dixie Carter.
That's right. But also on the Minneapolis show, you had Orndorff against Piper, which was pretty hot off TV. They had done a series of things. Bobby Heenan had a $25,000 bounty for the head of Paul Orndorff, who fired Bobby Heenan as his manager, even though he really wasn't his manager. After WrestleMania, it was a weird shift.
Yeah, the second time he was really his manager. The first time he was not.
Yeah. For some reason in wrestling, when you fire someone, you have to spell the words fired in case they miss it. So then you had no one had cashed in the $25,000 bounty. So Bobby Heenan raised it up to $50,000, and that got Piper interested. So Piper and Orndorff was a hot thing at that time as well. You also have Jesse Ventura on the show. And look, Jesse Ventura versus Uncle Elmer was as good as you can imagine. But Jesse Ventura was a big guy in the Minneapolis area. He was a big star with the AWA. So him being on that show was awesome. And Jim Brunzell's also on that show. The AWA show, I mean, it's indicative of the AWA at that time. One of the funny things in The Observer that week is when he mentions the Battle Royal won by Scott Hall. He calls Scott Hall a better conditioned, better looking, but worse worker than Hulk Hogan. which, you know, it's interesting.
Exactly.
Because that was what Vern wanted. Vern was hoping that Scott Hall from the American Starship was going to be his next Hulk Hogan, which, of course, did not pan out. And, yeah, I would have, even though I would have liked to see the Freebirds against the Road Warriors, I definitely would have gone to the WWF show.
Yes.
Now,
and then,
Vic,
what?
Brian mentioned the Meltzer-isms from these shows. Let me get off a few more of them real quick before you have your next point. All right. Bobby Heenan. He said, if you are even wondering for a second what Heenan was doing managing Savage, you are incapable of being a true blue WWF fan. A true WWF fan is incapable of either thought or wondering. Wow. Mr. T himself, the TV star, was there. The appearance of the slime bag drew a crowd of nearly 15,000, or very close to complete sell of the Met Center. The biggest crowd WWF has ever gotten in those parts. So that's an interesting stat. Their biggest crowd ever in Minneapolis.
And that's now, even bigger than Schultz Hogan or Hogan and Mean Gene against Fuji and Jake Steele.
Now, here's Meltzer on the AWA. Not to be outdone, Captain Vern and his sinking ship drew a healthy 12,000 people, announced as 16,000. And a couple of things here. It says Steve Regal lost his joke of a light heavyweight title to the brilliant Buck Zumhoff when Greg Gagne used hairspray in Steve's eyes. Sardis Sauter was a no-show. I hope he leaves the AWA because Vern is paying him good money. He doesn't work at all, nor does he draw flies. In his interviews, he talks about nothing but his movies and his dolls and never about his opponent, which may be part of the reason why he can't draw flies.
However, they got ESPN because one of the executives at ESPN was so impressed that AWA had Sergeant Slaughter. That's in the ESPN oral history book.
Yeah. So, which we'll back to touch on that in a second. But go ahead, Bix. What are your thoughts on this situation here?
What situation?
You were about to say something.
Oh, no. It made me think of that elsewhere, when you were talking about American Starship, that elsewhere in the Observer, I think the main one we were looking at for this week, that talking about how Dan Spivey, the other half of American Starship, had just started the new U.S. Express with Mike Rotundo, and how all of a sudden now he had a Barry Windham haircut,
yes,
Barry Windham boots,
yes,
and was doing the Bulldog as his finisher.
Yes.
Which, okay, he would probably know this better than me. Well, and also, Brian, you were actually just watching some of this stuff anyway, even before we decided we were doing this show. Like, I know that there's always been this kind of insinuation that they sort of pretended he was Barry Windham, but what exactly was it?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I recently did just go over all these episodes of 1985 Championship Wrestling, and there's a few things that I didn't realize. I didn't realize just how over Windham and Rotundo really were.
Oh, God. Like, if you watched – when they were getting the titles?
Yeah.
Fans jumping up and down, hugging each other, just loud pop. It's crazy.
Well, even the last match they had on TV, which happened a few weeks after they lost the title, Barry Windham, you know, they weren't even mentioned on TV for a few weeks, and then they were mentioned in an update, and then they came back, Barry Windham wearing an eye patch. The place, and they didn't come out to Born in the USA, which is the music that people recognize. They came out to Real American.
For the first and only time.
For the first and only time. And the place went nuts for them. And then the next week, all of a sudden, a tag team match is going to start, and Captain Lou comes out, followed by Rotundo, and they announce Syracuse, New York. As soon as they say Syracuse, the place pops, thinking it's Windham and Rotunda, and then a Junkyard Dog's with them. So it's Rotunda and Junkyard Dog, because Windham's already gone. Right around the same time, Dan Spivey debuts, and it's a really weird debut. There's a tag match in the ring, and Championship Wrestling 85 is all about weird tag teams being put together just to get as many guys on TV as possible each week. And the tag match is about to start, and they announce, here they are coming down the aisle from Tampa, Florida, Danny Spivey, and it's just crickets going off. No one knows who he is. And his partner from Tampa, Florida, is Paul Orndorff. So right away, they tried to latch him on to Orndorff. And Orndorff got a big pop because he was really, really over at that time. And then right after that match, there was a confrontation on Piper's Pit. The week before, Piper and Orton had called out Orndorff, excuse me, because he was now wearing a cast on his arm, saying, if Ace can wear a cast, I can wear a cast. And they were calling him out. He was in the ring. They were on the pit. They were going back and forth. He ran through the crowd to get to Piper's Pit. By that time, they were gone. So the next week, they call him out again, and he shows up there with Danny Spivey. And in Piper's Pit, you have Piper, Orton, the Hart Foundation, Jimmy Hart, Freddie Blassie, the recently debuted Hercules Hernandez, and the Dream Team, all, you know, trying to stand down Orndorff and the new Danny Spivey. And that was Danny Spivey's debut. And shortly thereafter, you know, of course, he would later be the Golden Boy, but they absolutely tried to, you know, without saying it's Barry Windham, they definitely tried to give you the impression it was Barry Windham. I mean, it was just, let's just get another guy with blonde hair, put him in the same outfit, and tag him with Rotunda.
Basically, they didn't act like he was a new guy.
Right. And the thing that's interesting, though, is they still popped for Rotunda that first week when it was him and JYD. Mm-hmm. As soon as they tag him with Spivey, the pops died pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So it wasn't, Spivey, they would never outright say, oh, it's Danny Spivey, who, as you know, is the partner of Mike Rotunda. But they didn't act like he's a new guy.
Right.
They took a tall blonde guy. They made him look and act like Barry Windham as much as he could. And they acted like he had always been there.
Yeah.
Correct.
Brilliant. Moving on back to the AWA.
Oh, well, Michael, we have to.
Michael Hayes and Buddy Roberts were fired on Thanksgiving night during the show in St. Paul. after their match with the Road Warriors, Buddy went off on a tirade where he mooned the crowd and then went into the fans and started fighting with them. Michael and Buddy were both put to be in the Battle Royal afterwards, but were removed immediately. Vern Gagne was also said that Terry Gordy was booked in Dallas instead of the promotion that was supposed to be his home promotion. Of course, we'll talk about that Dallas show later. Now, after the show, Vern did agree to let them work their scheduled dates, but after that, they were gone. Now, Buddy Roberts and Michael Hayes would never do such a thing. They are class gentlemen. They were the utmost dignity in this time period. Brian, I could never see them doing such.
I just want to say for the record, there's no way that those men would drink Jack Daniels before wrestling. No way.
No. They are choir boys. They drank orange juice.
I don't know why, but hearing that he mooned the crowd and then went in the crowd and started punching the fans makes me think this is Mexico or something. it's not the type of thing you hear about in the AWA.
Holy shit, Biz. Could you imagine Buddy Roberts working in Mexico?
I wonder if he did at any point.
I'm sure he probably did.
He would have been good.
But the Freebirds and AWA picks were just never a good fit. It just seemed like it was just wacky.
Yeah, and also not the most compatible weather for those guys.
Oh no, definitely.
And this was a Jack Briscoe in the WWF type of mismatch in that sense.
Yeah, totally. Now Brian mentioned ESPN earlier. Dave Meltzer reports that ESPN is ready to dump Vern, and they're bouncing his show all over the weekly schedule because they want to erode the rating away. ESPN never wanted Vern's show in the first place, but were pressured business-wise into doing so because of WWF being so hot, but the main mistake was picking the AWA. The story, though, was the third highest-rated program on the network behind college football and roller derby. But with a contract expiring in January, they're trying to ensure a ratings nosedive to keep from having to renew it. ESPN still wants wrestling, though, and has talked to both Mid-South and World Class about coming on board.
Okay, so obviously they did not get canceled.
No.
World Class, in some form, did not come along till close to a year later.
Correct.
And then AWA was gone till late 1990, and World Class didn't get a bigger presence till I think it was spring 88. So trying to figure out exactly what was the situation here.
I think that there may have been like a little shift in power in ESPN, and whoever was in charge did want wrestling on the network.
I guess so. I wonder why the AWA sticks around, though. I mean, why don't you – I mean, World Class – I mean, imagine if they got in the UWF. See, that's the thing. I mean, like, you would think this would be a good in for the UWF when they –
Well, when we talk about Mid-South in a little bit, this is – they're preparing for such a move.
Well, especially because also they were the ones – it seemed like they had the inside track to get the deal until the guy was like, hey, I know who Sergeant Slaughter is.
Well, I'd say exactly, and that goes back to what Brian has said. They recognized Sergeant Slaughter, and you know they had names that were known to Northeast guys.
Right.
You know, Larry Zbyszko, Sergeant Slaughter.
one of the biggest what ifs is if Mid-South had actually been able to nail down one of these cable channels, because obviously they were on that short run on TBS where they were the highest rated show on cable, and then they were in talks to get to have Turner partner with them, and they would take over the time spot when Turner was going to kick Vince off the air. Of course, Crockett purchases the time, and that never happens. And then this, you know, this wasn't the first discussion. They had been trying to get on ESPN for a while, and they couldn't. If they'd been able to get any of those cable outfits, it would have been maybe a game changer. And in terms of why they did keep AWA, even though they wanted to get rid of it, ESPN wasn't the powerhouse that it is now. It wasn't owned by Disney, and they needed those ratings. And again, it was the highest rated show on the network, or highest rated. Excuse me.
Yeah, and then what they did was they hooked it up with roller derby on this, you know, as a block.
Which I didn't realize they didn't do that at the. I thought they did that at the beginning. I didn't realize.
No, 86 is when they did that.
So slams and jams, right?
And people do not remember this. Brian, you were around. Roller derby was a big deal on ESPN in that time period.
Yeah.
You know, I used to watch it every week or every time it would come on. I loved it. And people talk about, you know, Dave covering the Observer, all this other stuff. I mean, yeah, it isn't pro wrestling, but
it's the closest thing to
pro wrestling. There is a lot of pro wrestling and roller derby. And it was fun as hell to watch. So I can understand why the ratings would be high as they were. And why they put the two together, you know? Yeah.
And again, at the time, ESPN didn't have baseball. They didn't have Monday Night Football. They didn't have anything. They had SportsCenter and then whatever they can – usually college games and then whatever else they could fill the programming schedule with.
Yeah, top-ranked boxing.
PKA kickboxing.
Yeah, they
bowling. They had bowling.
Yeah, they had lost the NBA the year before. So, I mean, they didn't have a whole. I think they did have the NHL, so they did have hockey. But it was just an interesting time in ESPN's history.
The NHL's cable history is very weird.
Oh, that would be a book.
There's another episode. Yeah,
that'd be a book. Right on that one. Now you mentioned Jim Brunzell earlier. Jim Brunzell's lawsuit against Vern Gagne for selling quote dolls unquote of him without permission was settled out of court. Brunzell would get all royalties, which Dave thinks won't be much, and punitive damages from Vern. It's not mentioned if Remco was also named in the lawsuit. Now, Bix, that was in the very first run of those dolls, and the High Flyers figures, I remember because I bought almost all those dolls of that first run when I was a kid. I never saw the High Flyers in the stores here.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if maybe they took them off the shelves quickly because of Brunzell, you know, leaving the promotion or what. But what do you think about this whole deal with the action figure lawsuit?
It's interesting because I think I'm trying to figure out if I was reading. Oh, no, it wasn't in the Observer. I think it was maybe in one of the combat sports issues from around that time, talking about how the AWA action figures were much lower priced than the WWF dolls.
Yes, very much lower priced.
Because people don't remember that those big solid rubber LJN WWF dolls, that they were like $12 each retail.
And you couldn't really do anything with them. You couldn't move them. You could move the AWA guys. No,
you could bend. You could bend them a little.
But even though the AWA figures sometimes looked exactly nothing like the people that they were.
They had the two body types and really just one body type at first, because it was the same body. It wasn't He-Man, but it was like whatever Remco's He-Man knockoff was.
Yes.
And then the faces were just kind of, you know, those hollow rubber heads with the.
They did a good job on some. That's what I said. It was frustrating because.
But some of them did look good. Like the Road Warriors look great. And
Carlos Colon and Abdullah were great looking figures. And then you had Stan Hansen in the same series. Looks nothing like Stan Hansen.
But they also did a great job with the accessories and the costumes.
And Michael Hayes' hair. The Michael Hayes figure's hair is awesome.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's like this. I don't know what you call the haircut, but it ain't Michael Hayes' hairstyle. But yeah, I love those Remco figures. I love the Freebirds because they had all their Confederate flag stuff, you know, and
fabulous ones with the suspenders.
The Fabs had the suspenders, yeah, and they had those cool little rings you could put on your fingers, the AWA rings.
Yeah. Road Warriors with the chaps and the collars and the
But now, Brian, you weren't an action figure guy at this time, were you?
Not at that time, but I later was. And actually, years later, I was able to get an unopened, not even in the packaging, but in plastic from the manufacturer, Freebird set, which I sold on eBay a few years ago for a nice sum of money.
Yes. That's what I was going to mention. These figures on eBay are very pricey.
I mean, if you have them without the stuff, they're not really worth anything, but you have them complete with all the accessories or in the package. Especially that last series.
Yeah, the last series is rare because I never even saw them in stores.
Who's in the last series?
Rockers, John Nord.
The Long Riders.
I don't know if Long Riders are the last series. Adnan.
They were in one of those
series. I didn't even know about that series. Wow.
Yeah.
It was Borsukov. It's called Matt Mania, I think.
Yeah, they're very, very rare.
Like, I don't know what they go for now, but it used to be you couldn't get them for less than like $500 each.
Yeah, they're very pricey.
But I'm trying to remember what were they, but the individual figures in stores were like what, $4 each, $5,
if that. Because I remember that they were. Very,
although they had a lot of the two packs too.
Yeah, I remember I used to get them at the TGNY store here in my town, which closed down not too long after that happened. At that time period, it's just going way back into an era I sorely miss. Yes. Now,
I don't even know when or how I would have gotten these because I didn't get these later. I mean, I had these when I was a youngin. I had the AWA Remco thumb wrestlers.
I remember them, but I never bought them. I was never a big thumb wrestler.
Like, I know I had, like, I think I had the Road Warriors and Rick Martel, and but
I may have had the Road Warriors, yes. I did the Road Warriors thumb wrestlers, but I didn't really care for them.
I mean, I don't even know how I would have gotten them. And I'm trying to think, did they make any other stuff? Because they made the thumb wrestlers, they had the regular action figures in the rings. I feel like I'm forgetting something.
Well, you know, slightly in line with this topic, something I always wanted when I was a kid I was never able to get. Do you remember right around this time, it must have been either a few months before it or a few months after it, in the Aptor magazines and other magazines, you'd see an ad for what was purported to be the never distributed Sergeant Slaughter LJN. It would be him standing on top of a pile of the LJN figures, the same.
Yeah, I remember that.
Okay, well, it was actually Hasbro made it. It was not made by LJN. It was made to look LJN style.
Yeah.
I mean, a little more cartoony, but LJN style. But Hasbro made that themselves through their deal with Slaughter. And I mean, yeah, that one is fairly hard to find. I mean, it's not like, you know, hundreds. I don't know if it's necessarily like hundreds and hundreds, like, you know, like those later AWA figures. But
And the Slaughter figure I got that one from the regular G.I. Joe.
The Real American Hero.
Yeah, the mail order figure.
Yeah, I think both those were mail order.
Yeah. Now, getting back on topic here, we go to Central States, which is quite an interesting territory at the time. And their Thanksgiving show in Kansas City drew a whopping 1,500 fans, which is probably pretty good for them. And here's their car. We had Art Cruz and Tarzan Goto going to a draw. We had Rufus R. Jones and beating the Samoan.
Do we know who that is?
I don't know which Samoan that is.
If I had to guess, it's Samu.
Maybe.
Samu was the one who worked the most as the Samoan, I think.
Yeah, it could have been. Brett Sawyer over Edgar Boo Thomas. Mr. Kareem Muhammad against going over Big John Harris.
Oh, my God.
Which sounds like it could have been one of the worst matches in history.
Pretty much. And we are big fans of Mr. Kareem Muhammad.
Big John Harris. Oh, my God. And there was a lot of rumors this time period that WF was bringing him in to be their next Andre the Giant.
Oh.
Yeah, God. I know. The Batten Twins battled Akio Sato and Sheik Abdullah to a DDQ. We have Bob Brown, the legendary Bulldog Bob Brown, going over Marty Jannetty in a tape fist match. And we had a Battle Royal won by Brett Sawyer, who also, the next week, won the Central States Heavyweight title from Marty Jannetty in Kansas City on December the 5th in front of 250 fans. There's your normal crowd, as Jannetty is on his way to the AWA.
Now, was Brett Sawyer a heel here? Or?
No, there was a face versus face.
That could be a really good match, though.
It could have been.
I mean, it's Kansas City, so you don't
depends
really
on Brett Sawyer's, you know, work ethic at that time, because
I guess
Brett was going through some things. But
I can't see. I can't think of Bob Brown these days though without thinking of, again, as always, going to plug the Chris Jericho 25th anniversary podcast though, because the greatest Bob Brown story I've ever heard is one of many on that podcast with Don Callis's amazing Bob Brown impression.
Yeah,
him tell like Jericho, I guess, had talked a lot about going to Japan, and Bob Brown one time said to him something like, "Kid, all you do is high spots. What are you going to do when you go to Japan? In Japan, they don't even do any high spots."
Yeah, because he had toured like all Japan. So, yeah, different style than what Jericho
was
going.
Well, still.
Yeah, I know, but, you know, this is Bob Brown. You got to remember, I'm sure there wasn't any – I mean, a drop kick was a high spot in a Bob Brown match. But, Brian, people forget
A clothesline is a high spot in a Bob Brown match. A punch is a high spot.
Yeah, people forget about Marty Jannetty's pre-Rockers career.
The Uptown Boys.
Pretty successful in the Central States area.
About as successful as you could be in the Central States area.
Right, right. I got to say.
Which is not successful at all.
Central States is the worst. I can't sit through an episode or a tape of it. I can't sit through any of it. It's the worst. It's a shame that they had, two NWA title changes in Kansas City? It's just... Yeah. The very worst promotion. And you look at this card, look up and down the lineup. Rufus R. Jones versus some mystery Samoan. That can't be anything but all sorts of awful. You have Mr. Kareem Muhammad versus Big John Harris. I don't know how many of the people listening know who Big John Harris is, so maybe we should talk a little bit about that. That could only be one of the worst matches of all time. I mean, Bob Brown versus anybody. The answer is no. It's just Central States is by far the worst promotion that for some reason was treated like it was a big promotion.
It happened to be within driving distance of St. Louis. That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Kansas City is a big market, although they went to Kansas City, Kansas. It wasn't Kansas City, Missouri.
Well, it's the same market, though.
Yeah, same market. But
what's the biggest crowd they ever drew?
They ran Kemper. I mean, they would run Kemper Arena when Flair would come to town and stuff like that. So they would do pretty good houses at Kemper when they wanted to, when they would load the card up. As I said, they had to load the card up, though, to get that house. But they were what they were. And you mentioned Big John Harris. Big John Harris in 1985 worked everywhere. World class. Memphis, AWA.
Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Pee-wee's Big Adventure. And I said WWF was looking at bringing him in to be like a new Andre the Giant type figure. I said Memphis earlier, which is a great video with Jerry Jarrett and Tony Yamamoto.
Yes, let's find the two shortest wrestlers we have.
Yeah. But my favorite Big John Harris memory moment is not inside the wrestling ring, but in the great Tom Hanks film, Bachelor Party, which I can't recommend highly.
Oh, my God. I know where you're going, and I'm so excited. That's one of my favorite movies of all time.
And a movie that Tom Hanks really doesn't want to talk about when it gets brought up, but he was fantastic in the movie. Big John Harris played the bodyguard for the Hindu pimp. And he comes to the hotel, and one of the few, his name is Milt. And the Hindu pimp, the Hindu pimp's saying is, if you screw, you know, you're talking about you screw around with, Milt's going to cut your balls off. And Milt, when you see Milt, he headbutts himself through a glass window or some deal. And then looks at the guy who's supposed to be buying the hookers, and he's scared to death. But anyway, Milt goes to the hotel once shit goes on because the Hindu pimp shows up, and he gets shot at from the hotel across the street, which is he was caught in a crossfire. But Milt shows up wanting to get the hookers, and I mean, it's just a
great. Do you remember his line? Do you remember his one line?
I'm here to get the hookers. Or something like that.
You girls the hookers, right?
You girls the hookers, right? I mean, you get everybody. You know, we're trying to give you homework for this show. Watch Bachelor Party. You got to watch this movie. It is phenomenal. And see, early Tom Hanks, I mean, this is like right before like Splash comes out and, you know, he breaks out on the scene. But Tom Hanks, Tawny Kitaen, Adrian Zemed is Tom Hanks' best friend. I mean, this is a fucking hilarious film.
I like how you just expected everyone listening to know who Adrian Zemed is.
Yeah, I mean, just watch it. Everybody just watch the film. That's your homework for the evening. Watch Bachelor Party.
Well, if you watch, he was T.J. Hooker, right?
Yes.
So if you if you watch a lot of Universal HD all day, and you see your for the T.J. Hooker reruns that have been remastered for no apparent reason, then you know who Adrian Zemed is.
Yeah, Adrian Zemed even sings in Bachelor Party. There's full frontal nudity. I mean, you get all kinds of goodness in this film. So
drugs to the left, hookers to the right.
Drugs to the left, hookers to the right. You get to see almost bestiality. I mean, it's fantastic film. So I can't recommend it highly enough. But
you get to see almost bestiality. I can't recommend it highly enough.
You do, but I'm gonna play spoiler just because it's so ridiculous. And then we'll move on. You almost get to see bestiality, but the donkey overdoses on cocaine. Go see this movie if you haven't seen it. It's amazing.
You have to. It's phenomenal. But anyway, moving on back into 1985 wrestling.
Speaking of bestiality.
We go to Texas All-Star.
Speaking of bestiality, again.
Yeah, there's all kind of animals running around there. Killer Tim Brooks, who is now assisting Gary Hart in the booking department, wanted Chavo Guerrero to put him over after taking the job. Well, after working the December 1st show in San Antonio, where he defeated Korchenko, Chavo decided to quit the promotion. And Al Madrill was given his USA heavyweight title instead. Chavo, while champion, was being phased out anyway.
Oh, boy. Al Madrill got a title. The promotion's dead.
Well, not just yet. Texas All-Star had a good little run after that.
I'll just throw this out there before we get back to what was actually happening here. Al Madrill, actually a good worker, good promo.
Yeah.
But why did he always end up in the dying promotions? Like right when they were dying?
I don't know. Just he had the shittiest luck, I guess. Well, he wasn't in world class when he was dying. He left. He actually left when they were getting hot.
Yeah, he left right before it turned
around. But he left when it looked like they were about to die.
No, he was there in the early Freebirds run.
The second one he came back.
Oh, yeah. I'm talking about the first run. Yeah, he left with the Portland. In which Portland was pretty hot.
When territories really started to die, though.
I'm talking about early before that.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, Chavo, this is a weird relationship going on here between, you know, Texas All-Star World Class are kind of working together here. And you know, guess what? Killer Brooks is transitioning over to Texas All-Star from World Class.
But Gary Hart's the booker, and he has heat with World Class, and Fred Baron kind of is the promoter, but he kind of has heat for splitting off from being their local promoter.
And you got Iceman Parsons is working both. There's crossovers going. Chris Adams is working both at this time period. There's a lot of crossover going on, even though there's heat between people and charge. So, weird situation. But Texas All-Star was a fun promotion, I thought.
And this period, late 85 into like mid 86 is really fun.
And Chavo, I mean, this is in 85. Chavo was mainly just working Texas area. They work in Houston. Is a separate deal, you know, from Mid-South, although he was in Mid-South earlier in the year.
And he's awesome. And all that stuff he did in Houston with his special feuds that him and Hector had, you know, with DiBiase and Doc, and then with the Fabulous Ones in a couple months after this.
Yeah, and just only in Houston. It's just saying, I don't know why Chavo didn't want to work in more regularly, but God, he was an awesome guy in this time period. It's a shame that we didn't get more high-profile Chavo matches from this era.
Although he did go back to Mid-South full-time.
That's right. Yeah. He was at UWF.
Yeah, a little bit, but Korchenko, that's another guy who, God, Brian, he stunk. He's one of the worst ever.
He's, I'm trying to think who's the worst Russian. He may be up there with Pietrov, or maybe the very worst of the worst Russians.
But Pietrov at least had the credibility of being Koloff's partner.
Right.
And he looked the part.
A hell of a drug dealer.
Was he?
You didn't know about this?
Maybe I forgot.
From when he got busted for being part of a coke dealing ring, then the observers would have the address for the Al Blake Defense Fund. No, like as a shoot, not even as a joke.
Well, I don't remember that. No. But Korchenko is he's one of the worst of all time, and somehow he parlayed that into getting a main event run in the UWF, one of the most memorable and hottest angles of that era. They're putting a flag on the cowboy where the Koloffs run in with Korchenko after Eddie Gilbert suckered Watts in, and they beat him up, bloody him up, put the Russian flag over him, and then shortly thereafter he left after I guess Watts had enough of him in the ring and started potatoing him, and Korchenko in his gear just left the building, and that was the last anyone saw of him.
what a character.
And now, like, if you in Mid-South or UWF, he never really talked. If you see him like in Memphis or
that Memphis
in
Memphis video, oh my god.
I think Memphis, and maybe also he worked
in
Texas.
That's on YouTube,
a little,
folks.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think it's even called Course to Korchenko, the worst Russian ever.
Yeah.
He's barely even trying with the accent. Actually, and then years later, in like 92, he starts his own promotion in Colorado. And actually, it was one of your tapes that I saw this on. He starts his own promotion where he does commentary with an American accent as Course to Korchenko. But it was actually pretty good. The little bit that we had, it was like Abdul the Butcher versus Eric Embry and stuff like that.
Was Dick Murdoch on that?
Maybe. At least it was only like half an hour long. No Dennis Condrey, unfortunately. Okay. Well, actually, because didn't Dennis Condrey like have his like own indie promotion where he repeatedly booked himself against Murdoch?
I think
in Colorado. So
yeah,
that sounds awesome. Now, speaking of not sounding awesome, Jeff Gaylord, a former lineman on the USFL San Antonio Gunslingers, made his debut on the December 1st show in San Antonio, teaming with his trainer, Tom Jones. Not the singer, although the way he wrestled, you thought he would be trained by a singer, to face the Hoods in the opening match of the show. Gaylord, a 6'5", 285-pound massive dude, that's Meltzer's words, is said to be extremely green, but is at least good as Tom McGee, if you take away McGee's gymnastic ability.
What an amazing sentence that is. Now, I guess McGee had just debuted, though, right?
Yeah.
So this would be going by the Choshu match, which was not terrible, right?
Yeah. But talk about Jeff Gaylord, Bix, one of our favorites.
What a wonderful, wonderful gift to this world Jeff Gaylord is. so many great stories. I mean, just probably the wrestler with the best look who walked around as if he was the biggest geek in the world. part of the Dream Team or whatever with Jeff Jarrett, and what was the other Dream Team or the Super Team?
Yeah, he was one of the Jeffs.
Yes, and then what was the other Dream Team or Super Team he was part of?
We talked about this on one of the previous shows.
Yes, I'm forgetting. Who was it?
Jeff Gaylord and Dr. Zahorian?
Bill Dundee? Was it Dundee?
No, I don't remember, but so many just different Jeff Gaylord things when, you know, so I guess he was not part of, I thought he was one of the UWF training school trainees, so I guess he wasn't.
Oh. Yes. Mr. Ebony, Tom Jones.
Oh, don't forget Bix when he jumped Eddie Gilbert at the Sportatorium.
I was going to get to that.
Okay, there you go.
That he, what was it? It was he stemming
Gordon
from,
Scazzari.
Right, Gordon Scazzari, who's a show into himself, was angry that Eddie took money to book and then didn't work the show. What was it?
Eddie was one of, you know, numerous men who took way too much money from Gordon Scazzari to book, and I guess he didn't show up, but he didn't refund the money.
Yeah, I don't think think he did work that. I know he didn't work that AWF taping for sure. I mean, because he's not on that show, and so Jeff Gaylord, I guess, at least attempted to beat up Gilbert, like the Sportatorium. Like you said, it was the Sportatorium or somewhere. He attempted to beat up Eddie because Scazzari hired him to. And then Medusa, who at the time was Gilbert's wife, beat up Gaylord.
No.
No, she beat up Scazzari, didn't she?
No, she beat up Gaylord.
She beat up Gaylord?
I think that was the story, yes.
But Jeff Gaylord jumping Eddie Gilbert's funny. It's usually a good idea not to beat up the only person that will book you.
Yeah, and I say Jeff Gaylord was always getting booked in Memphis or somewhere like that, and pretty much wherever Eddie Gilbert was, Jeff Gaylord was on the card somewhere.
And what else? Because at least recently was in jail, I think, or prison. Yeah. One friend of ours, who I will not name, once got Jamie Dundee's phone number and called him saying he was Jeff Gaylord, having just gotten out of prison. And then sent me the voicemail that Dundee replied with, where he's like, just like, fuck it, dude, Jeff, fuck, what's up, dude, fuck. I feel like I'm forgetting. Oh, and then, you know, when he goes to Wild West when the UWF closes and they use him as the spoiler, the new spoiler, just for no reason. And then World Class is using Don Jardine, who they start calling the original spoiler, and I'm sure that got him heat. That was probably not necessarily his fault, but who knows, with him, knowing him, probably was. They're just, like, I feel like I know more, but apparently there are tons and tons of Jeff Gaylord stories.
Yeah, he's something else. And the thing was, Jeff Gaylord was an All-American football player in Missouri.
I mean, yes, he did not wrestle like an elite athlete.
No, he was a really good football player. But wow.
Missouri Tiger.
Yeah, interesting. Now, going across state to World Class, Thanksgiving night at the Reunion Arena, 12,000 fans, $120,000 gate. We had the Grappler and the Missing Link going over Johnny Mantell and David DJ Peterson. Lance Von Erich going over Killer Brooks. Brian Adias retaining the Texas heavyweight title over Jack Victory. Kamala and the One Man Gang going to a double countout. Then One Man Gang beating Kamala by DQ. And then the One Man Gang beat Gary Hart in a 5-minute challenge. We had Iceman King Parsons in the American Heavyweight title match beating Rick Rude by DQ. We had a Steel Cage Texas Death Match. John Tatum going over Scott Casey. Gigolo Scott Casey. Then we had the Steel Cage match for the American tag titles, where the dynamic duo, Chris Adams and Jeter Hernandez, defeat Kerry and Kevin Von Erich to become the new champions.
This was, I mean, they have some good guys, but it just, you read that lineup and it just doesn't grab you at all aside from the main event.
And Terry Gordy and Brian Adias were referees in that main event. And Terry Gordy turned, basically, was Terry Gordy was not a heel yet. Still, I mean, he was still being cheered, but he became a heel in this match, and it was a couple weeks later when the Birds showed back up. So, yeah, this was the setup for that. So, yeah, you had that going on, but, yeah. This is like they're getting to – you're starting to see things are starting to go down a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, that Freebirds return kind of lit things back up a little bit, but it's also right after Geno dies, I believe, or right before – so it just kind of, it doesn't really work as well as it should, and then the Freebirds leave anyway. And but what it is one of the all time great World Class moments, though, because they're in Fort Worth, but they're in the they're not in the Coliseum. They're in the, what was it, the auditorium in the same building. So it's, they're on the the ring's on the stage, and the Freebirds just run in out of nowhere. And we get the all-time greatest Mark Lawrence line, or one of them, and there goes Kevin into the orchestra pit.
And this is the time period, I think, that David Manning may be booking.
No, not yet.
Because, well, Kim Mantell was having his problems.
But, no, it was still Kim Mantell.
Kim Mantell was still booking, but Kim Mantell was having problems at this time period.
But I think Manning was the official booker either right after Mantell left or between George Scott and Brody.
Yes. Now, Brian, Chris and Gino at this time period were wearing the mask as a dynamic duo because they had their head shaved at the Cotton Bowl in October. And I love that gimmick so much. I thought they were awesome in their mask gimmick. What did you think of Chris and Gino in this time period as a team?
Oh, big fan of Chris and Gino. I mean, really, that's the end of World Class to me. It's the Von Erichs versus the Freebirds into the Von Erichs versus the Dynamic Duo, and then it's just really, really bad. A few notes about this show that I notice here. The Missing Link's on the show. Missing Link had been in the WWF just a few weeks before this. He came in managed by Bobby Heenan, and then for reasons that happened a lot in 1985, all of a sudden he was with Jimmy Hart, and then he was on the wrestling album. Or at least the picture was, and then he was in gone.
Sports Illustrated too.
He was in Sports Illustrated, major picture of him there, and then he was gone. Chris and Gino, back to that, were great. I mean, Gino Hernandez, I feel like the appreciation for him has really grown in the last few years. Even
last
more,
few months especially.
Yeah, especially since the NWA Classics website has gone up and people have been able to see even more of his early work. But there are very few people in the history of the wrestling business that exuded that heel presence like Gino Hernandez did.
Phenomenal.
He was tremendous. And you know what? Chris Adams was a great babyface. And I loved Chris Adams as a heel. I when Chris Adams went from being that babyface to screaming at Kevin Von Erich over the microphone, I thought he was great. And again, this to me is the end of world class. There's a lot of things, as you're about to talk about, which start to happen right after this period with the NWA, with defections, with deaths. But this is really the end. And going back to one more thing about Bix mentioned his favorite Mark Lawrence line. My favorite is the winner of the match, Kevin.
That's all you need.
Well, there's...
You know who Kevin is.
Of course you do. What show are you watching? There are a couple other good ones, though, although they're more USWA era. There's the one that always gets quoted at Wrestling Classics, which actually someone found and is on YouTube, which is during a John Tatum match where Tessa is out there and Lawrence says, "If I had a swing set like that, I'd never leave my backyard." And then there's, of course...
And this man's a preacher, by the way. That's
right. And I believe at that point was actually working as a preacher.
Yes.
And then a little bit before that, when Terry the Beauty Garvin, of course, Terry Sims of the...
Terry Sims podcast.
Yes. Terry. He kisses Lawrence before a match where he was wrestling, you know, where he had the pink mat covering and all that.
Yeah.
And then... Lawrence says, "The beauty just kissed me. I don't know whether to laugh, cry, or get an AIDS test." This is 1989. 1989, everybody.
You know, one more thing about this show is Lance Von Erich's on here, and this was really the beginning of Lance Von Erich there. And if you read the Ring Around the Northwest from this time, covering the Pacific Northwest territory,
they
couldn't wait to get rid of Ricky Vaughn. The people there watching the matches couldn't wait for this guy to leave town. And, of course, he goes in there as the faux son of Waldo Von Erich, the faux nephew of Fritz Von Erich. And according to a lot of people, this is a theory that really became popular after the documentaries came out, especially from Gary Hart. This hurt world class big time locally because people knew he wasn't a Von Erich. They knew his name was Ricky Vaughn. And the Von Erich family lied to them and then later admitted it on TV.
Yeah, it's crazy. Now, one other thing I want to mention, the one-man gang Kamala Angle is spawned off Texas All-Star. Because one-man gang was a babyface in Texas All-Star. So that's where they're working together again here. So, it's just an interesting dynamic.
Now, also, actually, with Lance Von Erich, one of the clipping newsletters, so maybe it was either Combat Sports or Joe Shedlock's, had an article about Lance from, I guess, a Dallas paper where they talked about how his dad had kept him away from wrestling for a long time. But they call him Kevin Lance because his name was Kevin William Vaughn and then Ricky Vaughn. And they also they made reference to that, which is something that's been talked about sometimes, that the idea of there being a cousin Lance had been mentioned on TV for almost 2 years.
That's right.
Yeah, Michael Hayes on a promo in 1984.
Now, was that the first time? So it was after. So it was right after David died, right?
Yes.
So right after David dies, he's like, we got to have it. The crap. We've got to. I mean, I don't want to be that cynical of Fritz, but I mean, my understanding is it happened pretty quickly that they started planting the seeds.
It's okay to be cynical of Fritz.
Totally.
Well deserved.
Yeah, and speaking of Fritz, in the final straw that broke the camel's back between the World Class and the NWA, Ric Flair's tour that was scheduled for December was canceled by Jim Crockett Jr., and Fritz Von Erich is planning on pulling out of the NWA because he can't get any more bookings on the champion, which, in fact, Ric Flair's last match in World Class, if I'm not mistaken, was the Texas Stadium show in May. And he hadn't went back since then.
The match with Kevin?
Yeah. And Rick had been going more to Mid-South. Mm-hmm. So he, instead of going to World Class for tours, he was going to Mid-South for tours. Which was very interesting because Mid-South wasn't a member in the NWA.
They were an independent.
Yeah. But this, yeah, totally. This was.
As but they had a good working relationship with Crockett.
Right. Yeah, totally. At this time period, for sure. Now, deal here is that, you know, World Class and NWA were, I mean, that was a big deal that Devon Arrett was always going to be NWA champion. And of course, Kerry eventually became champion.
Well, they would even push, like, with Fritz, they would push. Now, Fritz was the AWA champion, but he was never the NWA champion.
Yeah.
I mean, they pushed the idea of the NWA and the NWA title very strongly.
Yeah, exactly. So that was a big deal. And then they created their own World Heavyweight Champion, and that flopped. So, I mean, this is World Class starting to go down the tube.
You know, within a two-month period, they say that we're leaving the NWA and our America's champion will now be the world champion. The Gino Hernandez dies. And then, of course, there's that great moment on TV where Bill Mercer says, "We've suffered two tragedies, the blinding of Chris Adams and the death of Gino Hernandez."
Yeah.
And then right after that, Ken Mantell leaves, and it's a mass exodus. It's the Freebirds, it's Sunshine, it's Chris Adams, Iceman Parsons, everyone who had been a mainstay in that area. And granted, many of them probably overstayed their welcome because crowds were going down. But now they all go to the UWF, which now begins to run in Dallas.
And then do the same angles they were doing in World Class, and then that Jerry Short tour is going down.
That's right.
And also, like, I'm curious what you guys think of this. Like, Gary Hart's theory was that Ken Mantell convinced Fritz to leave the NWA so that when Ken left for Watts and you know, helped Watts raid the talent, that Fritz wouldn't have any backup to help against Watts.
Exactly. Yeah.
I don't know.
Because you feel sense. Like – why? Because of the state of the NWA at the time?
Well, I think a few things. I think there were legitimate issues between Fritz and what was the NWA at the time because he wasn't getting dates on Ric Flair. And it's not like Ric Flair hadn't been a regular performer in that territory for 3 years. He had been in and out of there nonstop, drawing huge crowds, was a regular part of their television show. Even when he wasn't there, he was a presence that was always referred to, was always talked about. Clips were always shown of him. So all of a sudden, you can't get dates on the champion. It's not like some promoter can't get dates on the NWA champion. It's Fritz Von Erich, who was a major player in the NWA.
Former president.
Jack Atkinson, former president of the NWA. Major, major power broker within the National Wrestling Alliance. He can't get dates on the champion. So do I think there was a legitimate issue? Like, oh, I'm thinking about leaving, and Ken Mantell may have said, you know, you may want to do that. Right. Yeah, I think that's legitimate. Do I think Ken Mantell set up some plot, like, I'll get Fritz to leave, and then I'll go to Watts, and I'll take everyone, and no one will be there to protect him? There was no one there to protect him to begin with.
Yeah, you're right, but yeah, I can see Kim Mantell doing some shady shit though. He was a shady dude.
Shady. I'm not taking away that he's a shady motherfucker, but yeah. I just don't think even if someone had, it, let's say it turned around a little differently, and he hadn't left the NWA, and Watts had still raided all of his talent, who was good? What are you going to tell me that all of a sudden Crockett's going to send Dusty and the Road Warriors and Flair?
Yeah, it's not. It's
Dallas?
Not 1975. Yeah, it's 1985, not 1975.
Right.
So yeah, different era. Now, George Michael's Sports Machine, which syndicated around the United States on NBC affiliates, did a feature based on Von Erichs over that weekend where they called Kerry the best wrestler in the country, Kevin the most acrobatic wrestler in the country, and Mike, who they said had brain damage, but would be World Heavyweight Champion one day.
Aww.
Meltzer said he couldn't believe this made air, but it did.
He has brain damage, but...
But he could be World Heavyweight Champion one day.
You know, I recently watched it. Maybe the saddest thing in wrestling, or one of the saddest things of all time, is that Mike Von Erich press conference from the hospital.
Oh, it's terrible.
Where it's the doctor, and it's Kerry, and Kevin, and Mike. And I feel like Kevin does the majority of the talking about how, you know, a miracle happened. And, well, the miracle one was actually before that. But then, you know, Mike's going to be back. He's going to be better than ever. And then they go to Mike. And Mike, he was never a big guy to begin with, but now he's extra frail. And he's googly-eyed. I can't come up with a better term, and I'm not trying to put him down.
Bad.
And he's just – you could tell it's been put in his head, and he's just, I'm going to be at that Cotton Bowl. And he's having trouble putting sentences together.
And he never could talk right again either, they said. Right. I mean, you didn't see a lot of Mike promos after the fact. I mean, he never was the same.
I mean, and just other things too. I mean, like the, you know, the thing where, what was the thing where he like started beating up his car or whatever? Just all sorts of stories.
But
like,
didn't
just,
he got into a car accident, didn't he? Where he got thrown from his car?
I mean, just lots of stuff happened. And I mean, just, it was all like, even if he might have,
it was around this time. It was around this time period. I think it may be right after this.
Yeah. I mean, maybe he had some problems before because he was Von Erich, but he just became a different person.
Yeah. Now, on December 2nd, Fort Worth, Hollywood John Tatum was about to attack Sunshine when the Missing Link ran out and stopped Tatum, basically starting his babyface turn as Link had been ogling Sunshine from afar. Yeah, which, you know, Tatum had been feuding with Scott Casey, who was managed by Sunshine, and now the Link pretty much takes that spot. And this goes to talk about what happens in the future.
Yeah,
because they did the same exact angle with Dark Journey in UWF.
That's right.
You know, in 1986.
Every single person you just named in a few months is going to be in the UWF. John Tatum, Sunshine, The Missing Link, and The Missing Link doing the same thing. That's right.
Oh, another thing about Missy Hyatt in these issues of The Observer is Dave requesting tape of Missy Hyatt getting her shirt ripped off. So,
I'd like to request that tape as well. If anyone has 1985 Missy Hyatt getting her shirt ripped off.
Well, you could, I mean, 2000, you can watch 2001 Missy Hyatt with her shirt off.
Well, that's not the same thing. Whether you have feelings about whether or not that's positive or negative, it's just definitely not the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. And now we are moving on to Continental Championship Wrestling, one of my all-time favorite territories. And they had a Thanksgiving show at the Boutwell Auditorium. We had Ken Timms and Roy Lee Welch going to a draw. We had Mr. Olympia, Jerry Stubbs, going over Kent Glover. We had Scott and Steve Armstrong going over the Star Fighters.
Wait, who was that?
A couple of job guys.
Was that Steve Constance and Tim Ashley?
No.
Okay. What was their masked name?
They
in
were
Memphis?
the Daydreamers.
Okay, that's right.
And then we had an Indian strap match between Exotic Adrian Street and Norval Austin with Street winning.
Well, I guess Linda used to be a fake Indian, so.
Aww.
I'm trying to figure out why it's an Indian strap match.
Well, it was a strap match, and all.
You didn't know that Linda, when she was a wrestler in England, Miss Linda was Blackfoot Sue.
Oh no,
S I O U X.
I didn't know that at all.
Yeah, the hair. She could. I mean, it could pass.
Think Princess Paula.
I'm not up to date on my 70s women British wrestling. Sorry.
Then we had the Bullet, Bob Armstrong, Brad Armstrong, and Roberto Soto going over the Flame. Of course, Jody Hamilton, the Assassin. Robert Fuller and Tom Lentz, who is playing Boomer H. Lynch at this point in Continental. And our main event was a Loser Leaves Town versus The Mask, where Johnny and Tommy Rich beat the Nightmares. And I'm going to tell you this right now. That is a great feud. And there's another match in there, as we'll talk about in a little bit, that happened the week after. But Johnny and Tommy Rich versus Nightmares is a great, great feud. But Continental this time, Bix, just fantastic television every week. And Mid-South gets all the love, you know, and rightfully so. They were awesome. But there were weeks there, and Continental probably had the better television show over Mid-South.
I haven't seen that much from 85, but really from that late Southeastern era and then like the first few years of Continental. I mean, they ran really great week-to-week television to the point that, and even though the Eddie Gilbert stuff was really, really good, I think the way people talk about it does not give enough credit to the pre-Gilbert Continental stuff.
Yes.
I think it's more – I think people were frustrated with the relative what's the word I'm looking for? Like, staleness.
Colorism?
Of the roster.
Sameness.
Sameness is probably a better word than stale, because it wasn't stale.
Fullerism.
Definitely. I mean, the same guys are getting pushed over and over again. And they're different, maybe different roles, maybe, because, you know, the Armstrongs left for Crockett, and, you know, the Stud Stable became baby faces, but then, of course, they turned and became heels again, feuding with the Nightmares, and then the Armstrongs came back. Well, Bullet Bob came back, and then right back, you know, square one again.
Yeah, but they really, I mean, you look at that show, they always had a really strong crew of good workers, like small crew, but good crew. And a lot of them were homesteaders, but still. You know, great workers, good promos, hot crowds, and really, I mean, once they became continental with the, you know, with the shows taped at the, was it, I guess it was the Batwell, right? Or was it
Batwell,
the Farm
Center? Batwell Auditorium.
Did they tape some at the Farm Center in Dublin? Or was that later?
Later on.
That was under Gilbert, right? Yeah. Okay.
Now, they would move to the fairgrounds in Birmingham on occasions later in the run when they couldn't sell at Batwell no more. But
yeah, I mean, this was a promotion that always had really good TV at Southeastern, but becoming continental and moving to, you know, to the Boutwell just gave them like really good, like heated TV.
Yeah, you know, yeah. Chris, to answer your earlier question about the love of Mid-South versus the love of Continental, Continental had a really solid crew, but Mid-South had star power. And also in terms of television, you know, Mid-South had two of the best of that era, Bill Watts and Jim Ross, doing alternating weeks of their show, the best commentators around outside of Lance Russell, you know, at that time.
Although, yeah, I mean, but there was time where Continental would have hotter angles. They would, you know, all their matches would almost always be like main event matches. They would have some job matches here and there, but most of the time it was main event matches. And maybe they didn't last long, but they were still, you know, the top guys as top guys. And it was rare at that time to get that every week on television.
Yeah, and there's just something about like that Alabama East Tennessee style wrestling that I've always loved.
Yeah.
Like, I can't even put my finger on it. Like, in a, I guess one thing way you could put it is that in a way it's more Southern, for lack of a better term.
Yeah. It's not Memphis style, but it's like a more grittier Memphis style.
Yeah. But it's grittier, but also feels, the TV feels bigger.
Yeah. Because it was in an arena.
Right. Yeah. And just little things like just there's like I can't even explain it. Like when I think of like an angle like where it was the Fullers and Dr. Tom were feuding with I think the Riches, right?
Steve Armstrong.
Oh, no. It's Steve Armstrong and the Steve Armstrong and the Riches. And then Johnny Rich coming in as the intern to counteract Dr. Tom. And just like it's one of those things that it doesn't even sound that good on paper. But when you see it, it's just like the way it was done. Yeah, it was just really executed well. It just has a certain flair to it that other territories didn't necessarily have as an inherent thing, if that makes sense. Like,
yeah,
it has its own kind of personality and rhythm the way that a Memphis or a Mid-South did, but still different from those. It really had its own personality.
Exactly. And speaking of television, we have a little promotional war going on
and
here.
This story is amazing, and I don't think any of us had ever heard the story before.
Right, it's amazing.
I knew of it because I had seen the television that Gordon went on talking about this.
Okay, so let's see.
There is a promotional war going on in this area as Nick Gulas has bought TV time in the local markets, showing old clips of Mario Savoldi's ICW from earlier in the year in preparation for live shows starting up in January. Gulas has enlisted Louis Tillette, who was a longtime guy around the area, booked for the Fullers for years, booked all over the South, and Austin Idol, who was one of the top stars for Continental before splitting off with Gulas to help with the promotion. Ida was very upset with how the promotion had treated him in his eyes and was angry that they didn't support him booking shows in smaller Alabama towns by sending good enough talent to work. Ida had been working some shows in Memphis between leaving Continental and going to Gulas, where the Fullers thought he was coming back, so they were surprised that he went with Gulas. Gulas bought Continental's original time slot in Birmingham, forcing Continental to be shown at a later time on Saturday nights. And the ICW TV that is being shown there is announced by Gordon Solie, who is also the announcer in Continental. Solie only announced 13 shows for ICW, and after receiving what he thought was low pay, he severed all ties with the group. Gordon also didn't want his work in ICW to go national because of his other commitments. But the Savoldis broke that promise and turned Gordon's 13 shows into 39 shows, which has seriously angered Solie. In fact, he actually sued them. Gordon made a statement on the December 2nd Continental TV show, shown in Birmingham only, expressing his feelings about the situation to discredit Gulas. There are some fans, though, that hope this situation will lead to Continental improving their promotion and bring in some better talent.
Okay,
real quick, the week after that TV, mm-hmm. Gordon went on and buried Austin Idol, and called him Dennis McCord on television. So he's not even Austin Allen anyway. He's Dennis McCord. So that happened on December 9th. But go ahead.
the 13 Gordon shows becoming 39 is such a quintessentially Mario Savoldi thing to do.
Yeah.
In every way, both from an ethical perspective and a, well, that's how ICW TV worked perspective.
Yeah, I've been a wrestling fan for years. I was a tape trader. I've watched so much wrestling. There's a good chance that the match I've seen the most is still Vic Steamboat versus Tony Atlas.
Oh, God, yeah. And I hardly ever saw ICW, but I saw that match every time I saw ICW. That match was awesome.
Well, that or also Tasmaniac against Joe Savoldi.
Or the battle for who is the greatest Intercontinental Champion of all time, which went nowhere.
And who also who has the greatest neckbreaker of all time.
And Curly Moe.
or the Chris Cruz rap generic wraparounds that were the same every week.
Yeah.
Or that same Curly Moe thing for his Curly's Classic Corner. Trying to think what else aired just over and over. David Schultz against Rudy Diamond.
Yeah.
from this era. It was Les Thatcher who took over for Sully, right?
Yes. Les Thatcher and Lute Thesz.
And then Austin Idol came in, and that's when they had...
Lute Thesz would never work for any type of outlaw group.
No, never, never. He was an NWA loyalist through and through. And then the Thatcher and Thesz pair, well, I think at first it was just Thatcher, and then Thesz comes in, and that's probably, like, around this time, because that's one of the few times where you watch ICW TV, and even though it's probably only, like, one taping, it still sort of feels like more of a real promotion.
Yeah.
Because they're actually shooting angles and stuff. That's when they had Idol in. So it's probably around this time. And they also use a clip from Continental on ICW TV to push Idol.
Yeah, that's the Flair Idol match, yeah. Which, so, that's from Southeastern.
Well, yeah, maybe it's the same promotion.
But yeah.
I had no idea this happened. This is fascinating. I mean, Savoldi is an interesting character, isn't he? I mean... At least it was brought into two different promotions to help out and ended up leaving with the TV equipment and tapes like 25 years apart.
Opportunist, man. He is an opportunist.
I Amarillo and IWA Puerto Rico. I've even heard people say that he took tapes from Amarillo, so he may be the one guy with Amarillo tapes.
Yeah, exactly.
And that just massive storage facility he has of, like, all the random shit that Mario Savoldi has taped of. I mean, Brian will probably agree with me on this. ICW TV, if you grew up in, like, the Northeast, it shaped how you viewed wrestling and discovered wrestling.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you had the WWF, you had WCW or NWA, whatever you want to call it. If you had ESPN, you had AWA up to a point, and then AWA aired for a little while on Sports Channel. You had World Class reruns on ESPN.
And you also had World Class on MSG and Sports Channel, depending on the era.
Right. Now, I don't remember when it started, but ICW or IWCCW, as it was called, was on Sports Channel every week for years. Like, yep. Somehow they got that time spot, which is amazing, because it was the worst show in wrestling. And how did they even explain? Because World Class was folded into the USWA, you know, storyline wise.
Yeah.
How did they explain the merger between ICW and World Class on their show?
Other than they just said it happened?
Is that all it
was? I think so. Well, I mean, no, wait. Now, in the USWA storyline, though, it was World Class absorb as World Class killed.
It was killed and changed to the USWA. I guess that'd be the way to put it, right?
Well, because the USWA was the governing body that oversaw World Class at that point. So,
yeah.
And you could really – it's whatever. I mean, World Class had started to back up on its own before that happened anyway.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there was so much stuff. I mean, you'd see all of a sudden here's the sheep herders in Southwest from 1983.
I think the first time I ever saw Memphis was there was a match randomly in the middle of ICW or IWCCW, Bill Dundee versus someone from the studio. And I'd never seen, like, that studio before. I was like, what is this? Yeah. And then it was back to, you know, Curly Moe.
And then, but then all sorts of other stuff, too. The first time I ever remember seeing a full episode of the UWF.
That's right. They aired them for 2 weeks in a row. They aired December of 86 stuff.
And there were no wraparounds or anything. It was just all of a sudden, here's an episode of the UWF. It's like, wait, Ted DiBiase? And he's a good guy? And
I got so excited because that aired 1 week. And then the next week it aired again. And I'm thinking, holy shit, are we going to get this every week now? And that was it.
Right, because like at that point, like neither, I don't think either of us would have ever seen it before, but like we both knew of the legacy of the old UWF.
Yeah, but still, yeah. I'd never, I mean, it's when the show opens and it's Michael Hayes and Jim Ross, I'm like, whoa, what is this?
Right, and also,
and then, everyone was on there.
And Lex Luger and Hiro Matsuda in Florida, that video aired over and over on ICW.
That's right.
Yeah, total mixed bag promotion, no doubt.
Other Florida stuff. And then just other, because they'd work with other companies. Like, they, you know, Kevin Sullivan was booking ICW at the same time he was booking Florida.
Yeah.
So, and Continental, I think, too.
No, not yet, no.
But, okay, but later. Still. But he brought in Florida guys, Wyndham and Mulligan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So exactly. to go back to this story, is this, I actually don't know for sure, because I really didn't know too much about this whole story. Is this the last time Nick Gulas is up and running?
No.
No.
He still ran into the late 80s.
Yeah, he kept trying and trying and trying and until he got too old to quit trying.
And well, and there's that classic angle from CWA Memphis TV.
Involving Robert Fuller.
Right, with the Robert Fuller-Jeff Jarrett feud.
Yeah.
Where Fuller brings on Nick Gulas to cut a promo on Jerry Jarrett.
Yeah.
From wow. That was from 88, right? When Fuller was booking.
Yes. Crazy. Now back to Continental. Roberto Soto defeated The Flame for the Continental Heavyweight title on December 2nd in Birmingham. And also on this show, Tommy and Johnny Rich defeated the Nightmares in a match where the losers got their hair dyed and the Nightmares stayed true to this gimmick for over a year. So the Nightmares lose their mask 1 week. Well, in fact, not even a week. 4 days. They lose their mask 4 days and then they have to wear hair dye on one side of their hair for whenever they decide to quit doing it. And they, like I said, they went to other territories and kept that gimmick going. In fact, Ken Wayne kept that gimmick going for longer than Danny Davis did. But what they did was they would put a star over their face and paint-wise to since they didn't have the mask anymore. But again, Nightmares and Rich is a great feud. Nightmares are underrated as hell as a tag team.
Oh, I mean, whatever you want to call them, whether it's the Nightmares, Nightmare and Speed, the Tennessee Studs, as they were in Calgary. Just an awesome team. Both great workers. Ken, did we ever find out how his legal troubles got resolved, though?
No, I haven't heard anything.
He showed back up at Wrestling Classics, unless it's one of his kids.
It could have been, but...
I didn't want to say... I wasn't sure if I should say anything unless we know how that ended. But great workers, though. And Danny Davis, though, upstanding guy.
Yeah. Exactly. Now, moving on to Florida.
And a hell of a trainer.
Yeah, as was mentioned.
Well, and you know what? Kept waiting a hell of a trainer, too.
Ron Slinker, who had been brought in by Blackjack Mulligan to assist the family in their war with Kevin Sullivan, turned on him on December the 1st in Orlando as when Mark Lewin and Kevin Sullivan are using the spike on Mulligan, Kendall Windham jumped in the cage to help his old man. Slinker then ran out and seemed to help the Windhams, but he attacked Blackjack with a 2x4 instead. Lex Luger then stood outside the cage and kept Barry Windham from getting in. Now, Ron Slinker and Blackjack Mulligan, ever since listening to Flair's podcast, think about Blackjack beating the shit out of Ron Slinker.
I didn't hear that one.
Yeah, and Flair's told that story like 3 times on his podcast. But Ron Slinker was a tough dude. You know, he was a legitimate karate guy, and Mulligan just beat the shit out of him.
Well, Blackjack Mulligan was a very large man.
Yeah. But this is the era of Florida here, Brian, where they're starting to go down the hill too. Even though Lex Luger, is just now really getting going as a push commodity. But man, Florida is suffering.
Anytime you have Ron Slinker and Kendall Windham in the main feud, you're in trouble. Florida was really bad at this time. Look, Luger was coming up, and that's sort of exciting, I guess, in retrospect more than maybe at the actual time, just because you know what he became. But I thought Florida was pretty bad consistently the entire year of 1985.
Exactly. And yeah, Kevin Sullivan was in full Sullivan mode this time, Biggs. I mean, there was all kinds of wild, violent angles going on in Florida. A lot of weirdness.
Well, and it got even more over the top, like in '86 too. I mean,
yeah.
Well, in general,
really
Florida,
over the top.
Florida was bad in '85, and then it just in '86. It was. I mean, you do have Battle of the Belts with the great Flair Windham match, but otherwise,
yeah.
terrible.
I mean, nothing. Yeah.
I mean, it's 85 at least has some angles, some stuff to happen. 86 is just the most nothing happening promotion. Aside from the occasional wacky Kevin Sullivan promo.
I mean, 85 starts with the Freebirds in there, and 85 ends with, you know, this. That's really.
And 86 did have, like, the fabulous One Sheepherder's feud that was pretty good. And Ron Bass and Barry Windham had some good stuff, but it's a shell of itself.
They actually had some good talent for such a nothing happening office.
Yeah, it wasn't what it was, put that way. Now Memphis, we'll go to next. They're going through an interesting little time period here. It's Bill Dundee's back as a booker, and on November 25th, 1985, they have a show at the Mid South Coliseum. We have Tojo Yamamoto going over Tony Falk, Memphis Vice, Jerry Bryant, Lou Winston going over Tracy Smothers and Billy Travis. The Freedom Fighters, who we'll talk about in a minute, going over Tom Branch and the Spoiler, Frank Morrell. The Fabulous Ones going over the Heavenly Bodies, as they were known at this time, Tom Pritchard and Pat Rose, with Sherry Martel as their manager. Then we have Coco Ware going over Bill Dundee by DQ. Dutch Mantel retaining his international heavyweight title over Phil Hickerson. The Fantastics going over Taurus Bulba and Rip Morgan. Jerry Lawler going over the Guru, who is Jerry Gray. Tom Branch and Bill Dundee going over Jerry Lawler and Eddie Marlin. And a battle royal won by Jerry Lawler, where Tony Falk was tarred and feathered. It was a turkey battle royal.
That's an interesting card, because you've still got some of your remnants of your Tom Ernesto era.
Yeah.
But things are recovering, but it's weird because you've got some guys left over. You still have got, you know, Tom Branch, who's Tom Ernesto Jr. But you've got a lot of good workers there. But it's a little. It just doesn't feel quite like they've turned things around 100%. Yeah. Although no, they've. I mean, in terms of the lineup. But I mean, by this point, we're full into the Lawler Dundee feud.
Yes.
Which is incredible. That whole period is just Dundee. This is would you say this is the best work of Dundee's career? I feel like it is.
I think so. I thought he was phenomenal
as a promo in the ring.
Yeah, everything. Even starting in Mid-South when he turned heel there and carried it over.
But, I mean, the whole angle where he beats Lawler to win the Southern title, and which is like a 40-minute angle.
Yeah.
And then it just leads into this, which then leads into the stuff in early 86. And him, you know, just the whole thing is just fantastic. And then the angle where he puts up his shot against Ric Flair, against Coco, and Coco beats him for that on TV.
Which the story is that Dundee didn't want to job to Flair. So he put Coco in the spot. And Flair, that's why Flair has a huge heat with Dundee.
Flair has never forgotten it, because it's to the point where Flair will, for no reason at all, on his podcast, rip Bill Dundee to the point where he says, you know, it's not even about Bill Dundee the wrestler. He insults Bill Dundee the booker. Like, how dare Bill Dundee be on the booking committee in WCW? What has he ever done?
Well, he had been a successful booker in a promotion that Flair made money in.
Yeah, but he wouldn't do the job for Flair. So that's what it is. That's what it comes down to. But, yeah, Memphis is – they're going through a transition. And it was mentioned Tom Ernesto and his son, Tom Branch, both quit the promotion on December the 1st. And I thought that Tom Ernesto was an odd fit in Memphis. That time span, you know, in middle 85, going into the fall, it was just a weird time. It was post-Jimmy Hart. And Memphis never really recovered from Jimmy Hart's absence. Everybody, you know, it should know that. They just never did.
And Eddie Gilbert's gone too.
Eddie Gilbert's gone. I mean, it's just a weird time period.
And the thing to me that always sticks out from then is your top heel tag team is the still very green Billy Joe Travis and Ron Sexton.
Yeah, that was
by Buddy Wayne.
Exactly, at one point in time, yeah.
And Tom Branch is your top singles heel, with his gimmick being that he's a terrible wrestler.
And then you had Tiger Conway Jr. coming in as Bota.
No, but I mean, are we sure that's Tiger Conway Jr.? I thought that was a matter of controversy.
From people I saw they said it was Tiger Conway Jr.
Yeah, and when I say that about Tom Branch, I'm not kidding. Like, he had a hair match with Lawler, where the story of the match is that he keeps using foreign objects and cheating, and Lawler keeps kicking out because Tom Branch is a terrible wrestler. And he actually was not a bad worker, but it's very, very weird stuff. I mean, the actual top heel is really Tom Ernesto as the heel matchmaker.
Yeah, they were doing that, you know, well before other promotions were doing that.
I mean, he was probably the first one that ever did it, and he did a good job, I thought, on TV, and he had some interesting ideas, but clearly he had zero talent connections.
Yeah.
Although there was that one really cool episode where Lawler finally has enough of Tom Renesto, and Renesto says, "You can't fire me. The only person that could fire me is Jerry Jarrett." And it was almost like a work shoot kind of thing before that was a popular way of doing television.
Yeah, Memphis did a lot of those. So, yeah, there was some fun television, but it was just an interesting time period in Memphis. It was weird, I guess, compared to the years before.
But not having Hart, Gilbert, when Gilbert had really just started to heat up, Savage left right around then, and then Dundee was still gone. No, but I'm saying Dundee was gone, so.
Yeah. But now you got Dundee and Dutch coming back in, so now you're starting
Coco's back.
Yeah, the Fabs were there. You know, Coco was still there, although they were about to leave. But you know, that's what, you know, Fantastics were being brought in to replace the Fabs. But yeah, it's just an interesting talent turnover. Now on the December 2nd Mid South Coliseum show, Tony Fall gets embarrassed again as Jerry Lawler beats him in a match where the loser got diapered. Tony Fall always was involved in some wacky ass shit. So.
I mean, even later when he was like an established veteran wrestler in the territory, when Power Pro started up, his gimmick was being Randy Hale's lackey.
Yeah. he was an interesting character in the business.
Good worker, though.
Yeah. Now, part of this new talent initiative that was going on in Memphis was these two guys known as the Freedom Fighters, who I mentioned earlier. And on the December 7th WMC show in Memphis, the Freedom Fighters turned on Phil Hickerson when they were making fun of his physique, and it wound up with Hickerson beating up on Jim Hellwig until Steve Borden interfered. Now, Dave Meltzer on the Freedom Fighters. This is verbatim from Dave. The Freedom Fighters are Steve Borden and Jim Hellwig, and they're two gigantic muscle guys from Southern California, with Borden being a big, make that huge guy, and Hellwig is the most muscular big guy I've ever seen in wrestling. He's much larger than both of the Road Warriors. Plus, he's got matinee idol looks. My immediate reaction was if he could wrestle a lick, he'd really be something. When they got into the ring, they were the two worst wrestlers I've ever seen. They make Kendall Windham look like Satoru Sayama. Honest. Now, they are just starting and could amount to something, but I've never seen anyone start off from such depths. Unless you see them, you won't be able to concoct the vision of how muscular and awful they are. I don't know if they can maintain those physiques in wrestling. I shouldn't say this, but I will anyway. The kind of money they're probably making wouldn't even pay half their bill at the pharmacy. The sight of these two super stiff guys beating up on Dickerson was hard to take. As big as they are the least menacing-looking people, as they look like harmless models. And when they try to beat up people, they are so slow and stiff, they even look worse. Nikita Koloff and Lance Von Erich are 1,000 times better than these two.
Chris.
Oh, wait a minute. What's that?
Have you figured out who I am yet?
Wow. Okay.
I see you losing control. Where is your confidence?
Moving on. Vix, Steve Borden and Jim Hellwig. They became pretty big stars, I would say.
For people who haven't seen them in Memphis and Mid-South, though, as the Freedom Fighters and the Blade Runners, it's not an exaggeration what Dave's talking about how huge they were. I mean, after they split up, they both slimmed down a lot.
Sting definitely cut.
Oh, Sting looked like he just completely went off the gas.
Yeah.
I mean, during that period. Warrior looked like he just realized he needed to just get smaller. It is an established thing from, you know, it was in Bill Watts' book that when he asked Sting to go off steroids when he was doing drug testing in WCW, that Sting said he had been on steroids literally his whole career.
Yeah.
So actually maybe he was still, that's actually scary though.
Yeah. You know, one of my favorite things about the Freedom Fighters in Memphis is it's one of the few times, maybe the only time, I'm trying to think of other examples where two huge roided up guys were in a territory and all the heels on interviews, I remember Jonathan Boyd doing Phil Hickerson, would point out that these guys are just on steroids. Like, on the actual show.
Well, I was just going to bring that up, though. I mean, the great you know, the great Phil Hickerson line, all you need to know how to do is pump that damn steroids into your booties.
And Phil Hickerson was babyface. So as I said, this is what turned it up. Turned them heel was because Phil was a babyface at this time period.
Yeah, and
they aligned with Buddy Wayne, well, who was the secondary heel manager, or maybe the primary heel manager at that time period. And it had a great birthday party for Buddy Wayne, which is a whole other angle that people got to watch.
Yes, with them as the Blade Runners in their party hats.
Yeah, but
and they,
yeah.
They were also part of the. They were still around when Dundee had the celebration for Lawler losing, right?
Yeah.
I think they're in that too with the party hats.
Yeah.
But they, I mean, they were not good.
They loved the party.
Part of the reason they weren't good, they were so terrible, was that they left in the middle of their training. They were like, hey, we know enough.
Yeah.
That Red Biestine is, we don't need to listen to him anymore.
Exactly.
And they just sent the pictures around. Jerry Jarrett was the only one that answered them, which was why Sting had such loyalty to Jerry Jarrett. And that was that.
Yeah, and Meltzer saying they wouldn't be able to afford their pharmacy bill was not at all far off.
No. Because they weren't getting paid that much, I tell you that.
Yeah.
It was what it was. It was a moment in time. And go check it out on YouTube.
The other thing is, like, when you think about that, there's not a – is that there wasn't a stigma in talking about steroids on promos back then.
Oh, Bill Walsh did it a lot.
Yeah, or Hercules in his own promos in Mid-South, you know, whatever, yeah. With the line was 400 cc's of Dianabol a day as he pointed to his arms.
Yeah, I mean, it was prevalent in that era, so just a different time and place. Now, speaking of Mid-South, we go there now, and they had a show at the Superdome on Thanksgiving night to go with the Starrcade Closed Circuit. So, yeah, they those fans got a great night. They got a hell of a show on the closed circuit and some pretty good matches live. Nick Patrick, the referee, who was an active wrestler this time period, went over Tommy Wright. We had Hacksaw Butch Reed and Hacksaw Jim Duggan going over Dick Slater and Buzz Sawyer by DQ. And that was a great feud. And Jake the Snake Roberts going over Lord Humongous. Now, this show was held along with a closed circuit show on a Starrcade, doing a $98,500 gate with Starrcade all together. Doing a rough estimate of $1.035 million around the country. Whew. Not bad for that era. You got to say that. But
is this the first? I'm wondering, is this the first show, even though it's closed circuit and all that, is this the first show to draw $1 million gate to do a total $1 million gross?
I think it probably put it all together, yeah.
Interesting that you don't hear that talked about.
No, it is interesting you don't hear that talked about.
As far as the show,
and none of these matches, I think, ever made tape.
I don't think so. I'm guessing that Joe Ott shot them, but
this era Mid-South, you're seeing less and less of that stuff being on tape.
Right. Although there's stuff that, like, different sources had and didn't have. Like, I mean, of that, like, there was stuff that, you know, from the stuff that used to get traded around back in the day, there was stuff that was on there that wasn't on the Watts site, and the Watts site had stuff that didn't used to float around, and then the stuff that Brian was able to get from Watts had even other matches that weren't on either of those, like Jake Roberts versus Ric Flair was from the stuff you got, but it wasn't that I never saw anywhere else.
Yeah, this is right in your wheelhouse, Brian. Talk about that whole deal with the Mid-South House Show footage.
Well, you know, it was something they recorded regularly and aired on Power Pro Wrestling throughout 84 and 85. And then once, you know, they do the expansion in 86 and they change the name to the UWF and they go to Fort Worth and Fort Worth becomes the Power Pro show. They stop airing arena matches. So I think that's right around the time they stopped filming arena matches. Those matches are really great to watch because, you know, a lot of them, most of them have no commentary. So you really get to hear how heated that territory was. And you really get to see what were the best workers in the business in a territory where the owner forced you to work as hard as you can every night. So you get great, great matches. Some of those Midnight Express House Show matches are just phenomenal. Midnight Express against Fantastics. There's one with Midnight Express and Ernie Ladd against Duggan and the Rock and Roll Express that I always really loved.
From Houston, I love that match.
There's
one from New Orleans that's great too.
The New Orleans one is the one I was thinking of. Because Houston, I almost consider different just because they were filming all their shows. So it's not like they were filming house shows. It was great stuff. You know, one thing I see when I look at this at Mid-South, you know, there's been a lot throughout the years of what happened. You know, how did this territory that had a record year in 84 die by 87? And everyone, you know, there are different things people point to. One of the ones that became a popular reason, started by Bill Watts, was the oil crisis, that the oil crisis destroyed everything for everyone. You know, one of the things I think may not have been the primary thing, but was certainly important, is that there were guys who were steadies there, who were regulars, who were pushed, and then they were gone. Look at this card right here at the Starcade at New Orleans. You had Hacksaw Duggan and Butch Reed against Dick Slater and Buzz Sawyer. Butch Reed was a major star, could have gone further. He's gone within the next couple weeks.
You know the reason for that, right?
What is for the rodeo?
For no.
Drugs. He was on drugs so bad, his wife made him come home to Kansas City.
I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah. He did work for a while. Then he started working for Bob Geigel. Yeah, Butch Reed worked Kansas City for months before he went to the WWE. Yeah. So then he had to go clean up.
He also worked for AWA a little.
That's right.
No, that was before.
You're right.
Yeah, he had to go to rehab, I think, if I'm mistaken. He went somewhere and cleaned up.
And then Dick Slater and Buzz Sawyer were gone pretty quickly. Jake Roberts was gone within 2 months. Lord Humongous, he wasn't a major star, but he was gone.
And of course,
that major, major angle that was right before this time that we're talking about, where Ted DiBiase turns babyface because Dick Murdoch attacks him. After that, you see DiBiase go to Japan playing off the injury and come back. And then really there's no end to that feud with Dick Murdoch. It just dies. They have a few house show matches and then Murdoch's gone. So there was like a wall almost where it was the UWF started and a lot of the guys and the angles and the things you saw before were just killed. And another thing I think hurt Watts' territory is more than any other territory, even with the Road Warriors having regular commitments in Japan, Japan decimated Watts.
Oh, totally. Mm-hmm. Yeah. DiBiase could never be the champion because he was always gone. Then Gordy would get more regular bookings.
Everyone kept breaking each other's arms so they could go to Japan.
Dr. Death, Duggan. Yeah. It was just a mess. So yeah, those are all great points. There's a lot of factors that contribute into the demise of Mid-South.
And of course, with Murdoch left because of Jim Helwig and Steve Borden.
Yeah.
Because Watts decided to fire Kelly Kaniski, who was close with and who was working as Mass Superstar number two.
Yeah.
And Murdoch was angry, like, because how are you going to, you know, keep those guys and fire this guy, you know, who's, you know, good worker, kind of colorless, but a good worker, comes from a wrestling family, et cetera.
Yeah.
And Watts was like, you know, the potential these guys have, you got to take a chance. And Murdoch was so pissed off that he
could. I mean, it worked out with Sting. Rock, on the other hand, Jim Helwig, not so much. Because he left.
Sting was the better athlete.
Yeah,
and Sting had a more coachable mentality. Probably that probably had to do with it, that he had been a basketball player.
Yeah, and Helwig, you know, is just stubborn. But yeah, I mean, you can see where Murdoch would have got upset. You know that.
Plus he had a very interesting relationship with Watts anyway. Despite being one of his biggest stars, it seemed like Watts was always willing to fire Dick Murdoch on the spot, even with that.
Yeah, that was a love hate relationship.
And when Murdoch came back, it was after Watts was gone.
That's right.
Yeah. Now,
also, I just want to add,
Was in charge.
Yeah.
We didn't really say this about Duggan and Reed against Slater and Buzz Sawyer sounds absolutely incredible.
That's what I said. It's a great, great feud, all those guys together. You know, the Reed Slater stuff was great. Duggan and Sawyer was great. I mean, this was a hot time in
Duggan
in
and Slater,
South.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of hot stuff going on.
Now, was Slater booking yet?
Yes.
Dick Slater is booking, yes.
This is the last period of really great Dick Slater stuff. Because after this, what is there?
Yeah. I mean, well, he was good in WCW in 89, but he wasn't really a presence.
It's hit and miss.
He had good matches, but he didn't really.
This is the end of Dick Slater as a regular performer.
As a star.
After this, he becomes the Rebel. And then he's in and out of WCW various times from 89 to 92. 94 he was back, wasn't he?
Oh, no, 95, yeah. 95, 96, jeez.
Yeah.
He won the tag titles.
Exactly.
I mean, forgot about that. That's crazy. But he really, I mean, the era of Mid-South that he booked is really, really good. Like, I think the pre-UWF and early UWF, so really the 86 pre-Ken Mantell period is really underrated.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And they've got great hot TV from Tulsa. And they, but they've still got the, for a lot of it, they still got those legacy Mid-South guys. I mean, it's just really, really good.
Yeah. Now, the, another end of an era is December the 4th, where the last TV tapings at the Irish Manila Boys Club took place in Shreveport, Louisiana, as they are going to start taping at the big arenas in Oklahoma City and Tulsa, starting at the latter on December 18th. The plan is to make their show look more like world class and to push for a deal on a major cable network. And they are bringing in Ric Flair as a special draw.
I thought the first Tulsa taping was New Year's Day, or Oklahoma City. I thought the first one was New Year's
Day. It's Oklahoma City. I got confused there. So Oklahoma City was on the 18th and Tulsa on New Year's Day. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you could definitely tell the difference in product, you know, once it hit the arenas. But I think that may also contribute as well to some of their issues because
yes,
they were taping the TV in Oklahoma City and Tulsa.
That's,
you know,
right,
in their building. So it's not house shows anymore. So, yeah, I mean, you lose that TV venue, and Irish Manila Boys Club was always a fun venue to, for television. So, interesting. And some of the key matches from that, they're doing their Mid-South TV title tournament.
Which was completely incomprehensible.
Well, the second time that year they had done the tournament.
No, but I remember, like, when they started doing the Tulsa show and Oklahoma City shows, it was like round 30.
Yeah, well, that's what they did on – that's how they did on the other show, other one. They in the, each individual match was a round. Yeah, okay. Ricky Gibson and Tommy Wright. Ricky Gibson over him. Nightmare, which was Randy Cully over Sean O'Reilly. Dick Slater over Al Perez. Jake Roberts over Eddie Gilbert. Buzz Sawyer over Nate Patrick. Steve Williams over Rob Recksteiner. And Hacksaw Duggan over Lord Humongous. So there are your TV matches. And the Duggan Humongous was the last match ever to be recorded from the Irish Manila Boys Club.
Didn't they actually bill him as Rob Recksteiner?
Yeah, Rob Recksteiner, yeah.
No, but I'm saying because Recksteiner is his real name, but they billed him as Rob Recksteiner.
Yes.
Yeah, but they spelt it, if I'm not mistaken, as Recksteiner.
No, they spelled it Recksteiner.
They eventually spelled it Recksteiner, yeah.
Yeah, they eventually did, but not at the beginning.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so.
And he was gigantic.
Oh, yeah, he was big.
His shoulders were huge, yeah.
Now, what your thoughts about the Irish Manila Boys Club, Brian? I mean, like I said, that was a great venue for their television, I thought.
Oh, it was a really, really cool venue. So much of my favorite stuff I've ever seen on wrestling is in that venue, you know, where you see the wrestler come to the ring from the right side and, you know, the interviews Bill Watts sometimes did right in front of the ring, you know, best shown with the angle where the Midnight Express and Jim Cornette attack Bill Watts, which is one of the coolest things ever because Butch Reed, who's the top heel, just doesn't want to be involved. It's so nasty, even he doesn't want to be involved, that he turns around and walks away. Really, really cool building. They had the little announcer set towards the back of where the camera was, I guess, so that that's where they would do interviews and wraparounds. And it was really cool. And you had a really cool crowd. And especially in 84, when all of a sudden that crowd became filled up with young people and girls, you got a really, really cool environment, a really cool atmosphere for professional wrestling.
You know what I would compare it to would be like the WWF shows at Allentown in Hamburg as far as what the building was like, but as Southern Studio Wrestling.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I guess that's fair.
Now, Mass Superstar and the Sheep Herders, they're both coming in January. Which Bill Eadie, which we'll talk about him in a little bit in the WWF section.
And they were all really good in Mid-South, although neither was – well, actually, the Sheep Herders did stick around, but Superstar wasn't there long, but he was really good while he was there.
Exactly. So, yes, a couple things to look forward to. And the deal Kim Mantell had come to – the deal Kim Mantell had to come in had apparently fallen through, Dave said. There are a lot of rumors surrounding this, so I'll just leave it at that.
Dun dun dun!
You gotta ask him, Bix. What are the rumors?
What?
What are the rumors surrounding why the deal died there?
Oh, it didn't say. No, I'm just saying. It didn't really say anything, though.
You gotta ask. You have to ask Dave.
Oh, as Dave. Oh, okay, I thought you were saying ask Chris.
That would mean Dave had to talk to Bix.
I mean, can you email him?
But yeah, I mean, well, of course, that, you know, Mantell was in not too long after that, so whatever was going on obviously wasn't a deterrent to the situation in the long run. But the rumblings are there.
Didn't Watts also end up selling those Jesus infused vitamins with Mantell years later?
Yes.
What were those called?
I don't remember. I guess it's in his book, maybe. I don't know. And now let's go to the World Wrestling Federation. And King Kong Bundy, who had a personal services deal with New Japan, has pulled out of that contract due to his commitments with WWF. As Vince McMahon is making sure all of his guys are no longer under any type of deal with Japanese promotions, as he is planning on running shows there in the spring. Well, this comes up a lot on these shows, doesn't it? The British Bulldogs are currently working the Real World Tag League for All Japan, but aren't happy with their treatment. Both Bundy and the Bulldogs were originally booked for January tours. Yeah, Biggs, I mean, yeah, we talked about this a lot. WWF in Japan, there was a fascination there, and it just didn't happen.
Yeah, and the Bulldogs thing, I almost forgot about that. At this, even at this point, they're still not really under contract.
Yeah,
they're sort of pushed, but not exactly. And then I think this was their last tour, I believe.
Yes.
And then they signed the contract to get the tag titles.
Yeah, well, they were treated like mid-carders on the Real World Tag League.
Yeah, and you know, the TV for Championship Wrestling, the WWF Championship Wrestling, around this time, mid to late November, is when the Bulldogs come out and they're in the ring for a match. And before the match starts, Howard Finkel announces, I've just been informed by the Bulldogs, here is their new manager, and Lou Albano comes out. So it's right around this period where they really start getting the big push. They beat the Dream Team on TV the week before that by disqualification, where they really dominated them. So this is the beginning of their major push in WWF.
Yeah. Now, Masked Superstar was set to come to the WWF at the end of the year after his New Japan tour. But the situation with Vince wanting none of his guys to go to Japan made Superstar change his mind.
So, of course, he goes to the promotion that just signed the deal with New Japan.
Yeah, and then eventually went to WWF not too long after this as a super machine, which is hilarious. But yeah, there you go.
And he his career from he had a very weird career for a few years there.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to think going back to when he left WWF the first time.
Yeah.
Because I'm trying to think. So then what was his first stop after that in 84?
Georgia.
So right, he goes to Georgia. Then, I mean, he had the brief stop for Stampede Week in Calgary where he was the IWA World Heavyweight Champion in Calgary.
Went to Montreal to transition AWA. You know, going back and forth to New Japan.
Cup of coffee in Florida.
Supposed to come in for Crockett, build him on television, is coming in, never come in.
Actually, wait, when was the Florida run?
That was in 85. He had a very small stint, but yeah.
And then it seems like he's finally going to, you know, settle into Mid-South, and then that doesn't really happen either.
Exactly. Now, Hercules Hernandez made his TV debut on the November 30th episode of Championship Wrestling, but Meltzer saying he has become a clone of Bruiser Brody and Hacksaw Duggan, which is funny because if you watch early Hacksaw Duggan, he's a clone of Bruiser Brody. Brian, you've watched all this stuff. Thoughts on Hercules' debut?
I got to admit, I don't think he was. I wonder if Dave actually saw it or if he's going by a review because.
The look. He's going by the look.
Yeah. I mean, other than the fact he had long curly hair and a long beard, he didn't like do the Duggan stomp or, you know, Huss or any of those kind of things. He was in there, managed by Freddie Blassie, came out with no announcement beforehand. Here is Freddie Blassie and his new guy, Hercules Hernandez. And then the Piper's Pit I had mentioned previously in this podcast, where he had all the heels with him on his side, that was the week after. So I mean, that was the debut of Hercules Hernandez. It was nothing spectacular. You know, I'm a fan of Bruiser Brody, I'm a fan of Mid-South Hacksaw Duggan. I didn't watch this and think it was some sort of a clone or ripoff of them, other than appearance. But he's had that appearance, Hercules Hernandez, since Mid-South.
Right. And also Brody and Duggan did not have the leather accoutrement or whatever you would want to call that thing he wore.
He didn't yet either.
Okay.
He didn't yet either.
Although he was, I think, because he was on Tuesday Night Titans around this time, and Blassie calls him the greatest Latin wrestler of all time.
Well, his last name is Hernandez.
Yes.
But moving on, the WrestleMania home video is still a top 10 bestseller, though no other WWF videos are in the top 30.
Now, I'm trying to figure this out, though, because I guess you had stuff priced for sale, but this would have been a $60 price for rental video.
Yeah.
That would be in the top. So I'm just trying to figure out, though, like, top 10, what is it against? If it's still
Not a whole lot.
Is it selling to video stores, or is it just the sample size is so small that
It was also the only video of theirs that they pushed on Championship Wrestling each week.
Yeah, the other videos, they only it's weird now that you mentioned that they never really pushed the videos on TV that hard until, like, the late 80s. right? Exactly. I mean, until I guess it would be the end of the clamshell era, right? So like your best of the WWF Volume 16 type of period.
Yeah.
It's weird. Like, I never thought of that till now, that they never really, they pushed them in the magazines. They had the nice ads in the magazines, but never really on TV. And I wonder why. I guess because it was more of a rental market thing.
Yeah. Now, George the Animal Steel will be coming in full time at the end of his current school semester, where he was a teacher.
So, he actually had just re-debuted on TV right around this time with Lou Albano.
Yeah. And George was, you know, would be in for a little bit here, a little bit there. But yeah, when he comes in now for this full time, he's there for till 88. So yeah, he stayed there for quite a while after that and became a beloved character in the long run.
And never took a bump.
Never took a bump. He loved those turnbuckles, though.
Introduced the world to Mine.
Exactly.
Mine is one of the great collectibles now of in pro wrestling. If you can get the official Mine.
And I had George Animal Steel's LJN figure with the green tongue, which was a great figure.
Wow.
Now, Madison Square Garden had an interesting happening going on November 25th in front of 16,000 fans.
I'll say that.
We had the Spider Lady pinning WWF Women's Champion Wendy Richter to win the title in 6:38 with a small package, even though the champion clearly kicked out before 3. After the bout, Richter continued attacking the challenger and pulled her mask off to reveal her as the Fabulous Moolah, not realizing the match had ended. And once she did, she refused to give up the championship belt. The finish, which Richter was unaware, came as a result of a contract dispute with the champion. And moments later, Richter whipped Moolah out of the ring with the title belt. And this was Richter's last appearance in WWF until she was inducted into the Hall of Fame.
And by contract dispute, we mean Gorilla Monsoon shoved a contract in her face before the match, demanded she sign it, and she said, I got to get my lawyer to look over it. As any normal person would, and they're like, God damn it. You know, truly a great moment in petty pro wrestling history.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. There's this narrative that Wendy Richter wasn't at all over, and that, you know, obviously she wasn't a draw, but she wasn't in a position to be.
She was hot. She was a hot commodity there for a while.
Well, you know, watching these shows, she wasn't on very much in 85. You know,
84 was her peak.
84 was her peak, but 85 after WrestleMania, she wasn't on so much. But towards the end, it's really interesting knowing this is what happened, because all of a sudden in October, she appears again on the show. She fights Judy Martin with Moolah as her manager, as Judy Martin's manager. And she comes out to Girls Just Want to Have Fun and gets a major pop. I mean, it wasn't like they just cheered her because she was a babyface. They were going crazy for her. And then a couple of weeks later, they have a battle royal, a women's battle royal, a 7-woman battle royal. They couldn't even find 10. A 7-woman battle royal. And the spot is supposed to be Moolah and Wendy are going at it near the turnbuckle. And Judy Martin comes over and dumps them both over the rope. But Richter lands on the apron and rolls back in and eliminates Judy Martin and wins. Except what happened was Judy Martin comes and dumps both of them over and Wendy goes to the floor. The timekeeper rings the bell. Bruno and Vince are confused. Wendy gets back in the ring and they say, oh, she just landed on the apron. They go back to what it was supposed to be. And then she eliminates Judy Martin. They ring the bell again and they announce her as the winner and the place pops and goes crazy for her. She was still over even at the very end. And, you know, the other thing about this time in WWF that's very interesting, between her, between Snuka, between I just saw an ad on the television show for a calendar with Wyndham and Rotunda, they were marketing a lot of people that were in and out. That they didn't have locked down. They would still try and market figures or cartoons or calendars or whatever else for people they didn't have locked down.
Exactly.
And also, there was that thing that I found because it was in one of the newsletters around this time, but I couldn't figure out exactly when it was from, that Vince interview from the Boston Globe magazine. And it's relevant to this, because it was that thing I tweeted earlier in the week where they asked him, are you putting more effort into women's wrestling these days? And he said, yes, I see it as a growth area. I think that women's wrestling was an area that was overlooked for many years, and it wasn't until recently that a very, very attractive element physically began to enter ladies' wrestling. And with the advent of Cyndi Lauper and Wendy Richter now, there will be a deluge of female athletes who are nice-looking as well. Not that all women wrestlers have to be nice-looking, because they won't be, just as all male wrestlers aren't handsome devils.
Exactly. Now, also in that Madison Square Garden show, we had Terry Funk and Mr. Wrestling 2 which sounds like an interesting match. It aired on Primetime Wrestling on December the 10th. And went 13:54. You had the Funk and Hart chasing Mel Phillips around the ring. Wrestling 2 chased Funk out of the ring with a steel chair. Funk tried to brand him. So fun times had by all. Thanksgiving night in Hartford. They would run Hartford on Thanksgiving this time here because it's close to, you know, home base. And, of course, your main events there were Andre and Bundy to a double countout. And Hillbilly Jim and Tito against the Dream Team. Hillbilly Jim and Tito winning by DQ. Now, the next night, they ran Richfield Coliseum in Richfield, Ohio, which is where the Cavaliers used to play. And, yeah, a little bit of a stacked show. Tito and Bob Orton for the Intercontinental title. Paul Orndorff against Piper. And the main event, Hogan over Jesse Ventura in 13:20. 20,000 fans that show.
That was a hot city for them.
Yeah, they had a really good time in Cleveland. Now, back to St. Louis. In the local St. Louis TV over the weekend, Larry Matisic, who had been doing voiceover commentary for the syndicated WWF TV matches, was removed from that spot and did the Lord Alfred Hayes-style update spot instead, while the matches had the original commentary by Vince and Bruno Sammartino. This is interesting, because Matisic had been there since, you know, they bought out, you know, his slots in St. Louis, and now 2 years later, he's starting to get phased out.
But he was still a local promoter for years after this.
Yeah, a little bit.
Or local representative or whatever exactly it was.
But he's being phased off TV.
Yes.
Yes, no TV presence anymore. Now we're to full Vince mode.
Yeah, and I guess for the Hall of Fame, because we've been trying to figure it out, I guess this would be... I guess you could consider this the end, then, of his run. This would be the 30 years, and I guess next year he should be... I'm forgetting what we call it all of a sudden. The historical, I guess, right?
Yeah.
I guess this would make 30 years. I mean, unless you want to consider his update spot. But I would think this should be the end.
It should be, definitely. Now, Pittsburgh, on December the 6th, 14,000 strong. We had Hogan over Ventura. So Hogan and Ventura is drawing some strong houses around the horn. We had Orndorff and Steamboat over Morocco and Fuji. And in your Mike Rotundo substitution match of the night, Dream Team over Mike Rotundo and Mr. Wrestling 2 subbing for Barry Windham. So okay. Mr. Wrestling 2, it was Boston Garden, no crowd listed. Savage and Steamboat, which this match is on the
Steamboat
Ultimate Randy Savage collection.
Oh, it's the Randy Savage DVD, yeah.
Yeah, on the Randy Savage DVD. And then you have Bruno and Piper, which is on Bruno's Coliseum home video, which that was a fun match. Ventura against Tito for Intercontinental title, which a rare Ventura Intercontinental title match. And you had the Dream Team going over the Killer Bees to retain their tag titles.
This is a pretty loaded show.
Yeah, and that evening at the Spectrum, 12,158, you had Hogan and Terry Funk. Hogan pinned Funk after hitting him with Jimmy Hart's cowboy boot. Funk attacked Hogan with the ring bell and branded him with his branding iron, but Hogan grabbed the chair with Funk then leaving ringside. And now we got Mike Rotundo in a singles match against Greg Valentine. I guess they learned their lesson. Then you had Steamboat Morocco going to a double countout. And your last match, Tito and Tony Atlas going over Randy Savage and Jesse Ventura by DQ. Now, Randy Savage and Jesse Ventura had quite the partnership at this time, Brian, on television. And it seemed like there was going to be a regular deal, but it just didn't work out that way.
They showed up on TV. They announced that they were going to be teaming up. They came out with Elizabeth. And on commentary, Vince was saying, here's one of the newest tag teams in the World Wrestling Federation, Randy Savage and Jesse Ventura. And then after the match, Jesse Ventura and Randy also chipped in. Were yelling at Bruno. They were pointing and yelling at Bruno over by the announce spot. So it seemed like they were going to go somewhere. But again, 1985 Championship Wrestling, there were a lot of teams that started and just stopped all of a sudden in WWF.
Well, yeah, also, when did Jesse have to stop wrestling, too?
Early 86. Yeah. So that probably is why that happened. But, yeah, I remember they had something on the body shop where they were together. And Jesse would always stick up for Savage, even in commentary. Even as a babyface, he would you know, be pro-Savage. So there was that continuity there.
Well, and that was what made Jesse great, though, was that there was nuance to him as a heel announcer.
Yes.
Yes, totally. And on a note that I had to throw in here, even though it doesn't really, you know, matter in the long run, but on December the 7th, 1985, future WWE superstar John Moxley, a.k.a. Dean Ambrose, was born.
Which happened to be in the Observer for some reason. at the time.
Of course. Dave was a prophesizing the future Dean Ambrose. No, I'm just kidding. That was something I was looking up for birthdays and deaths and stuff like that, and there it was. So,
was there anything about Dick Slater having a baby?
No, there wasn't. Although he doesn't act like Dick Slater anymore. Oh. When he first was a singles guy, he was doing Dick Slater stuff. Now he's just been sterilized.
Well, you know what? He's a pro wrestler from the 80s. Maybe he has a lot of kids he doesn't know about.
Yeah, I mean, probably got that right. And probably Ambrose is maybe playing Dick Slater as the Rebel right now in WWF. Instead of Dick Slater in Mid-Atlantic circa 1984.
Well, he hasn't danced yet.
No, and we don't want him to dance. But on that note, this has been a really good show. Brian, you have a plug for us now.
I know we both have a plug, but I always have a plug. But
I want Brian to plug this one because you have a million plugs. So Brian, talk about this super podcast.
Well, first I'm going to say once again, because it made me laugh so much and I got such a kick out of it. Are you girls the hookers? So listen. Me and Bix, we enjoy talking wrestling, and I've enjoyed the times that I've – this is now twice. I'm the first repeat guest. Here on Between the Sheets. Me and Bix decided to start a podcast. It's called the 605 Super Podcast. We couldn't come up with a name. We had a lot of options, and we went back and forth. And then we decided 605, that kind of works. It has a wrestling connotation. Doesn't mean we're going to talk exclusively about TBS wrestling, but – it's an old school wrestling podcast where we're going to talk about various old school things. Basically, we have like two or three topics we start with, and then we don't know where we're going to go. So if you just want to hear general wrestling talk about old stuff by two Jewish people from Long Island, this is the show for you. 605 awesome. Super Podcast at 605pod.com. Is that correct, Ben?
Yes, 605pod.com. 605pod.com.
Yep. Soon to be on iTunes, but not there.
I submitted it earlier in the week, and I have not gotten the confirmation email yet. But it should have the feed info though. If you just want to subscribe manually, it's feeds.feedburner.com/605pod. But that should be on up on iTunes and maybe potentially other directories and stuff.
And a new show will be later this week.
Thursday. We're aiming for every Thursday.
Oh, awesome. That's good. Weekly show. All right, Bix, go over the rest of your mountain of plugs.
Buckle up.
So I have I have a new podcast called – no.
No, you better not.
I don't – you know what? I'll just try to leave the attention to 605 this week because we don't need to draw attention away from it. So.
Oh, okay.
So follow me on Twitter at David Bix. Everything else, you know where it is. So whatever. Or it'll be on Twitter. So whatever. 605pod.com. And we need to come up with what our jumping off points are for this week.
You girls the hookers, right?
Yeah.
We can talk about great wrestling hookers of the other variety and go up from there.
Yeah, exactly.
Ed Stranger Lewis and Sensational Sherry.
Oh. Yeah. I was going to say we can talk about Luthez and then the other types of hookers that were removed from his book.
But anyway, my plugs. Of course, Between the Sheets every Monday. So be on the lookout for that. Don't know what year we're going
to
do.
Be on the lookout for the podcast you're listening to right now, everybody.
Yeah, exactly. Every Monday. Always got to plug the show, man, because people may not come back.
Yeah.
So we got to keep them in.
You're right.
And Exile on Bad Street should be out sometime this week, going over the history of Smoky Mountain Wrestling. So be on the lookout for that.
Yes, for those of you who are wondering why the format for this week's show changed after being one of the few times where we actually announced it. There you go.
Yeah, real quickly. You know, I announced that, we were going to do 1995 on last week's show. And our buddy Tim Noel thought, you know, we was doing it as an exile. And Lions got confused. And I thought, well, since we're going to do – let's just do an exile with him instead of Between the Sheets. We'll have Tim on Between the Sheets in the future, no doubt, because he'd be a great guest. But – and then that's why I said, well, shit, let's do two weeks of 1985 to make up for it. So my
– and it's a year ending in a five, so.
Yeah, okay. And for my mistake, you get 2 weeks worth of great stuff. So, you know, it is what it is. And we got to have our long show because I know some people were upset last week that our show didn't go long enough.
It was only 2 hours and 45 minutes.
I know. Well, you get an extra hour a night just about, folks. So be proud of us as we did that. But anyway, follow me on Twitter at Chris Zellner, KRISZELLNER. And that's about it.
Oh, follow Brian on Twitter at Great Brian Last.
At Great Brian Last. That's right.
Before Halloween Havoc, you need to meet me again.
Who was that?
Sounds like Cookie Monster.
Yeah, or Cookie Puss. But on that note, we'll be back next week. Cookie Puss. And yeah, we'll see y'all guys later. So for Brian and for David, it's Chris saying so long from the Peach State of Georgia. Freeze frame!
Girls back in 45 minutes, or Milt cuts your balls off. Fair enough? Shake.